Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country tonight or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become than you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, and look out the window as we launch X Squared Radio. And greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome all around the world, on planet and off planet, to X Squared Radio. We're so glad you're here with us this evening. The solar wind is a respectable 445.7 kilometers per second, while the proton count is up to 4.8 protons per cubic centimeter. Sunspot 1076 is still active, but shows no threat to Earth. However, sounds like the sun is getting ready to wake up. Earth and space are about to come into contact in a way that's new to human history. To make preparations, authorities in Washington, D.C. are holding a meeting, the Space Weather Enterprise Forum, at the National Press Club on June 8th. It's a couple days from now. Many technologies of the 21st century are vulnerable to solar storms. Richard Fisher, head of NASA's Heliophysics Division, explains what it's all about. He says, "The sun is waking up from a very deep slumber, and in the next few years, we expect to see much higher levels of solar activity. At the same time, our technological society has developed an unprecedented sensitivity to solar storms. The intersection of these two issues is what we're getting together to discuss." The National Academy of Sciences framed the problem 2 years ago in a landmark report entitled "Severe Space Weather Events, Societal and Economic Impacts." It noted how people of the 21st century rely on high-tech systems for the basics of daily life. Smart power grids, GPS navigation, air travel, financial services, and emergency radio communications can all be knocked out by intense solar activity. A century-class solar storm, the Academy warned, could cause 20 times more economic damage than Hurricane Katrina. Much of the damage can be mitigated if managers know a storm is coming, putting satellites in safe mode and disconnecting transformers that can protect these assets from damaging electrical surges. Preventative action, however, requires accurate forecasting, a job that has been assigned to the NOAA. Space weather forecasting is still in its infancy, but we're making rapid progress, says Thomas Bogan, director of NOAA Space Weather Prediction Center in Boulder, Colorado. Bogan sees the collaboration between NASA and NOAA as key. And don't forget EUMETSAT, that's the European equivalent. NASA's fleet of Helios Physics Research spacecraft provides us with up-to-the-minute information about what's happening on the sun. And if you don't believe that, you can go to the new SDO website, the Solar Dynamics Observatory, and check it out for yourself. Some of these observations are quite stunning. It is the newest addition to NASA's fleet, just launched in February of this year. It is able to photograph solar active regions with unprecedented spectral, temporal, and spatial resolution. Believe me, it's the next best thing to being there, and I'm not so sure you'd want to be there. Bogdan's favorite satellite from NASA, however, it is an old one. The Advanced Composite Explorer, also called ACE, launched in 1997. Where would we be without it, he wonders. ACE is a solar wind monitor. That's how we get our numbers each week that we report to you here on X Squared Radio. It sits upstream between the sun and Earth, detecting solar wind gusts billion ton coronal mass ejections and radiation storms as much as 30 minutes before they hit our planet. Oh, that gives us plenty of warning, doesn't it? Anyway, 2010 marks the fourth year in a row that policymakers, researchers, legislators, and reporters have gathered in Washington, D.C. to share ideas about space weather. This year, forum organizers plan to sharpen the focus on critical infrastructure protection. The ultimate goal, of course, is to improve the nation's ability to prepare, mitigate, and reduce, and to respond to potentially devastating space weather events. The last time the sun was very active like this, we didn't have such a thing as the internet. So now we all rely on this very much. There were 22 earthquakes over 3.0 on the scale, and only two were only five. None of them were over six. All seems to be quiet on planet Earth. We've got a great show for you tonight. Actually, a program, not a show. I've got a great guest coming up, Jonathan Stern, the co-author of Minke Whales. If you haven't a chance to pick this book up, it's a wildlife library book. So the photography is color and just stunning. Russ Herzl and Jonathan Stern are the authors of Minke Whales, and we will be back in 40 seconds with them. So don't go away. We'll be back with X Squared Radio. The Obama administration is leading an effort within the International Whaling Commission to lift a 24-year international ban on commercial whaling for Japan, Norway, and Iceland, the remaining three countries in the 88-member commission that still hunt whales. The administration argues that the New Deal will save thousands of whales over the next decade by stopping the three countries from illegally exploiting loopholes in the memorandum. Several environmental groups have joined forces to pressure Obama to withdraw his support for the deal before the Whaling Commission votes on June 20th of this year in Morocco on whether to lift the ban that was championed by President Reagan. They are quoted by saying, "We ask you to honor your promise, Mr. President. Stop the sellout and save the whales." The ad reads, "The White House did not respond to an email seeking comment." To say that the moratorium doesn't work, that is a conscious effort to mislead or a complete misreading of the facts, Rampage said, adding that throwing it overboard in the name of good feeling and cooperation and conciliation with Japan is jaw-dropping. We're here at X Squared Radio, and we say we recognize whales as sentient beings with a right to live without predation by humans, who also claim to be sentient beings. Anyone who has an opinion out about this can call in tonight, because we have a leading marine biologist on our program tonight who can cover this with authority. Hang on one moment while I turn a light on. Speaking of the sun, we kind of rely on it for our light, unless we have a light to turn on. My guest tonight is Jonathan Stern. I have to tell you, I've already spoken to Jonathan, and I'm very impressed by his credentials. And if I can get to the point in the book where I'm talking about the author, because I'm captivated by the pictures, to tell you the truth. Let's see, Jonathan Stern, here we go, has earned his PhD at Texas A&M University Galveston, studying spatial and temporal distribution and movement patterns of baleen whales. These are whales that feed on small things like plankton and krill, and currently lectures in biology there. He has worked on studying the population biology and feeding ecology of marine mammals since the 1970s. completely qualified to speak on the subject and to be here on X Squared Radio tonight with us. Welcome to the program, Jonathan.
Thank you, Brooks. It's great to be here.
Right off the bat, what do you think about Obama's statement today that he's going to lift the moratorium on whaling?
Well, I'm not really happy with that. There's a lot of concern about what is going to happen with that moratorium lifted. It's a really complicated issue, however, and the idea that by lifting the moratorium, whales are going to be saved is kind of true on one hand, but on the other hand, it's not clear at all whether that is true in the long run.
Well, what kind of loopholes would Obama be talking about in the current whaling moratorium that the countries that claim some kind of indigenous right to be able to whale or to hunt whales, what kind of loophole would they be going through that would go away with a lifting of this moratorium?
Well, right now, Japan is using a loophole in the International Whaling Commission, or IWC, rules that allows them to take a certain number of whales each year for scientific research. Okay, there is a provision in the International Whaling Commission rules for Aboriginal people who rely on taking a small number of whales each year for subsistence. And currently, the United States is one of the countries that has used this provision in the IWC for the Inupiat people in northern Alaska to take a small number of bowhead whales every year. These people have taken bowhead whales historically for hundreds, if not thousands, of years, and they absolutely rely on the bowheads for subsistence, and they utilize the entire whale. So one of Japan's criticisms of the United States position is, you know, that the United States opposes us whaling, but is in fact allowing whaling to happen in their own national waters. So Japan, they have had in the past a culture where some small coastal villages have active whaling stations, and these small boats would go out and take a small number of minke whales or whatever whales were in the area per year. And so but that was a commercial hunt. And under the current guidelines or rules, commercial whaling is illegal. So,
well, the thing that I find interesting here is that with the moratorium, it appears that the numbers of whales that are taken are somewhere around 1,700 to 2,000 per year. Whereas before the moratorium was enacted, it was somewhere in the neighborhood of 60,000 whales that had been taken. So it's clearly a large difference. Now, you know, in my mind, I don't think that whales can overpopulate themselves in the world. I think that they regulate their own population. They were here for 100,000 years before modern man came along, at least in the numbers that we have now. And it would seem to me that there are all kinds of other fish in the sea, which we don't consider to be sentient beings, that would be a wonderful food for people. I mean, don't we learn from our experience and our discovery and learn that certain things we can continue and certain things we cannot?
Well, that's a good point. The problem is a lot of these fish stocks that we think are doing well and humans can actually go out and exploit really aren't. There's some research that was done a couple of years ago. It was published in Science Magazine that talked about the real possibility of the collapse of major fish stocks in the ocean within the next 50 years. So you know.
That's because of the fishing by men, right? By the netting of vast amounts of fish during the prime time of their life cycle.
Exactly. And, you know, and what you said earlier was absolutely right. I mean, whale populations will never get too big. They will regulate themselves. They're slow growing. Their population size reaches kind of a plateau that's determined by the number of resources that are out there to support them. And so, you know, whale populations and populations of any animal is going to sort of reach some type of equilibrium, at least in the short term or long term, just naturally, you know. And the idea is that, that, you know, if we have these populations and they're maintained, that, you know, we can go out and kill a certain number of whales and we won't drive them to extinction by taking a few whales a year. That sounds really great on paper, but historically that's not what humans have done.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, when you talk about populations being self-limiting based on the resources or the area in which they live, man is the only one that violates that. I mean, we undergo urban sprawl. We don't limit ourselves at all. We just keep building houses and extending the power lines further and further into the wilderness. Now, the minke whale that you mentioned earlier, this is a smaller, much faster whale. What size is their population compared to other whales on the planet, and where do they live normally?
Well, there's two different species of minke whales. There's the southern minke whale, which lives in the southern hemisphere, hence the name, I guess. And it's interesting. The population estimates about 10 years ago were around 760,000, but those estimates have dropped significantly over the past 10 years or so. And it's not really clear if the population is actually declining or we're just getting better at counting the whales that are there. But they're quite numerous relative to other species of whales, no matter what the true population size is. In the North Pacific Ocean, there's around 25 or 30,000 minke whales. And in the North Atlantic, there's around 150,000 to 200,000 minke whales.
Now these are a smaller, faster whale than what we're used to seeing popping up out of the water on National Geographic specials. How big is a minke whale and how fast does it swim?
Minke whales, they reach a maximum size of about 25 to 28 feet long. They can swim upwards of 25 to 30 knots. If they're startled, they could swim faster than that on short bursts. So, and one of the other things about minke whales is that they oftentimes don't swim in a straight line. Like if you've gone out and seen migrating gray whales that swim in a very straight, predictable fashion, minke whales will surface once heading south. The next time they're about 200 yards to the west heading in a completely different direction. They're absolutely squirrely in their movements. So keeping track of them and counting them is a really, really difficult thing.
Well, how old do they get? I mean, what's the lifespan of a minke whale?
Probably about 35 years for a minke whale. Aging baleen whales is a really difficult thing to do. You actually have to look at this plug of wax that develops in their ear, and this plug is laid down annually, and it has essentially what look like tree rings that you can count and figure out how old the whale is. The other way to count or to age a whale is actually to find the whale the year that it's born and follow it over many, many years until that whale, you know, dies or leaves the population. It's a real difficult thing to do, very time consuming. But in our studies, we've tracked individual whales over 20 years. We see the same individual whale in the same location year after year after year after year. So through a lot of effort, you can actually get good estimates of the age of all whales by going out and actually looking at them and not sticking a harpoon in them.
Yeah, I reckon so. And yeah. I like that way of aging. It sounds pretty accurate. humans are the same way. We age and count the age by the number of hairs growing out of their ears rather than the
we block.
It's a terrible thing, a curse. You have more hair coming out of your ears than you do out of the top of your head. I'm just kidding. What is the oldest living whale on the earth? Species.
In an evolutionary sense, or how?
No, I mean, what's their life?
How old can a whale live? Well, there's really interesting, compelling evidence of a bowhead whale, which is a whale that's confined to the Arctic Ocean, that was around 200 years old when it died.
Wow. And so that whale was around when we were still in wooden ships.
Exactly. And the way they aged this whale, well, initial studies is where they looked at the cornea of the eye, and you can actually do some analysis of the cornea of the eye and get some estimate as to how old the individual is. But with this one whale that was 200 years old, they found a harpoon point embedded in the blubber of this whale that was killed in a modern hunt. But the head of this harpoon had not been used for at least 200 years prior to that date.
Wow.
It's amazing.
Yeah, that really is amazing that we have sentient beings that have been on the planet that long, swam our oceans and experienced the ecology of the world. Now, you know a little bit more about whales than anybody that I've ever personally spoken to, so I'm going to ask you some more off-the-wall questions here. Let's talk about the social structure of whales. Do they mate for life? Do they live in families, pods? Do they travel together? Or do they split off and mix up?
Well, I think the first thing to do is to talk about the different kinds of whales very generally. First, there are toothed whales. These are whales that, surprisingly enough, have teeth. And then there are baleen whales. These are whales that, instead of having teeth, they have this keratin-like structure called baleen that hangs from the upper jaw. And they use this baleen to strain their food out of the water. So baleen whales and toothed whales are really different animals. In terms of the baleen whales, as far as anyone can tell, they form kind of loose associations where individuals will swim together for a period of time. They may or may not be related to one another in this group. There's some evidence, though, that's really, really kind of neat when they look at cooperative feeding groups of humpback whales, where there might be some degree of relatedness between individual whales. So they're helping relatives to be successful foragers, which is really kind of a neat thing. And humpback whales are one of the baleen whale species that most is known about in terms of their social structure. They live close to shore, a lot of the year, either on their breeding grounds or their calving grounds. So people have been able to get a good look into their lives. The toothed whales, on the other hand, like the dolphins, the porpoises, the killer whales, the sperm whales, they seem to have a really highly evolved social structure. Killer whales, for example, a species that I've spent a lot of time with, they form pods. And these pods are essentially a family group built around one or several matriarchs. So when you see a group of killer whales...
It's the female of the whales that actually lead the pack. And I guess when I think of toothed whales, that's what I think of, killer whales.
Yeah.
Now, what is unique about their pods and the way that they handle themselves in social groups?
Well, like I said, it's a matriarch. It's a mom with her offspring. Her sisters, perhaps, and other relatives, and these pods are very, very cohesive. They will fragment for a time, but usually these fragments will come back together to the main pod. Sometimes the pods will fragment and they'll go off on different you know, go their separate ways. But for the most part, they don't seem to do this. And
now, what about language? You know, a lot of people think that, well, and I'm one of them, that believe that whales have a very complex language with all kinds of clicks and squeals and groans, and their songs are quite beautiful, I think. But do they have different dialects, different languages between the different pods of whales?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. There's the clicks are the sounds that are used for echolocation or sonar, and that's what they use to find out about their environment. The other sounds, there's the whistles and burst pulses, are sounds that are used for communication. And these are the, you know, with the killer whales, you look at a group of killer whales, a pod of killer whales, and they each make their own, that pod makes their own distinct suite of sounds. And they'll live in the same area with another pod of killer whales that has their own distinct suite of sounds. Some of the sounds may overlap, but there are differences between adjacent pods. So, you know, if you stick a hydrophone in the water, which is an underwater microphone, and you listen to the sounds that are being projected into the water as whales are coming at night or something like that, you can tell which pod of whales it is based on the sounds that they're making. I mean, we can tell the difference between different pods of animals. They each have this different dialect, and they can recognize each other within a pod, and different pods can recognize those, you know, another pod, which is a really great thing to do. You know, we're visual animals. We're used to being able to look across the street and say, oh, there's Billy Bob or somebody. You know, but in the ocean, you don't have that visibility. Sound, however, can travel a great distance. And so whales have adapted to use sound and these abilities of sound to travel great distances to communicate with one another over great distances.
Now, I know you probably don't have a lexicon of whale sounds, but what is generally the method or the extent of this communication? I mean, do they flirt with each other? Do they tell jokes to one another? Or is it just about food and hunting and breeding?
Well, seeing as they usually make sounds when they're together, although an individual whale on his own may make sounds, that you got to assume there's a social context in their sounds, and they're making sounds when they're mating, they're making sounds when they're looking for food, they're making sounds when they're traveling. So I think the idea is these sounds are important to maintain contact with other members of the pod and to talk to other pods, perhaps. Whether or not they have a sense of humor, you know, it's really impossible to tell. It's only been, you know, quite recently that research was done and it was found that dolphins, bottlenose dolphins, the flipper dolphin that most of us are familiar with, they can actually recognize themselves in a mirror. They do have self-awareness. And so their abilities to communicate, it's thought, you know, have to do with an individual wanting to communicate to another individual. It's trying to say something. What it is, we haven't cracked that code yet. But it's absolutely fascinating to think about the possibilities.
Now, you can tell the difference, though, when they're excited or when they're using the language to communicate. And let's just talk about killer whales for the moment. They kind of hunt like wolves. I mean, they especially we had talked earlier about traveling pods of whales that are not, shall we say, ones that live off of a local area. They travel from area to area wherever the prey are. But they don't hunt by instinct. They hunt by skill like wolves do. Tell us how that happens. What do the whales do that's different when they're hunting?
Well, the whales that hunt marine mammals like porpoises and seals are hunting an animal that is very aware that they are hunted. And they're very aware that they're being hunted by killer whales. And their prey, these porpoises, dolphins, seals, can recognize the sounds made by these transient killer whales, these mammal-eating killer whales. So these mammal-eating killer whales, when they're looking for food, remain absolutely silent. And they travel between areas that have a high likelihood of seals being there or porpoises being there. And so, you know, if they go to an area where they expect porpoises to be and there's no porpoises, they go to the next place. And if there's no porpoises there, they go to the next place.
Well, how do they find the spotlets? I mean, there's got to be some kind of coordination between them besides eyesight. I mean, it's not like, hey, I'll hold my fin up on the right and then you flank the prey on the left. How do they communicate if they're moving in silence? They're like on radio silence on purpose.
Exactly. Well, they know, it's like they know where to go to have a high likelihood of finding prey, where seals will haul out. You know, and seals haul out when the tide is going down, and they leave the rocks, the haul outs, when the tide comes up. So the whales know what's going on with the tides. You know, they're very aware of their environment. So they time their arrival at these different places to coincide with whatever environmental conditions increase their chances of finding prey. And once an individual finds a seal, finds a porpoise, then they might start vocalizing, and the other members of the pod come over to assist if need be.
I got you. So yes. Once there's been visual contact and the level of panic and, say, the sea lion is up and he realizes he's been picked off from the herd, he's away from rocks, and it's only a matter of time before they hunt him down. I mean, he's doing all the evasive maneuvers that are so rapid the cameraman can't keep up with him, and yet the whales can keep up with him.
Oh, exactly. And a lot of times these little porpoises, they're fast, they're maneuverable, they can get away. So, you know, these aren't just dumb little prey items that are sitting there ready to get picked off. They're really good at evading their prey. So the predator, these killer whales, have to adapt to their prey. And as the prey adapts, the predator has to adapt. It's this kind of technological sort of, you know, advance that the predator and prey are constantly playing with each other.
I wonder if we've seen a change in that one-upmanship. If, you know, you mentioned that the killer whales have adapted by going into radio silence until they find the prey, and then I'm sure they have, you know, their A play that they do, like, okay, let's run at them this way, and usually the herd or the flock or whatever you call a group of dolphins or seals will break up in a certain manner, and then we'll start vocalizing with another. This displays a very high level of sentience and planning and intelligence. So how has that adapted over the years that you've been watching whales?
Well, there's been reports and studies that have been done on killer whales in other parts of the world, like in Argentina, where the killer whales, they know that at a certain time of the year, there's a lot of young sea lions and seals in this one location. And they also know that these young animals are not very wary of predators, and they'll oftentimes play at the edge of the water. And these whales have learned to literally beach themselves to pluck a seal off the beach. And not only, I mean, and this is something that has been documented for decades now. And whales will, you know, adult whales will teach the younger whales how to do this. You know, an adult whale will go pick a seal off the beach, bring it out to deeper water where they release the seal, and the young killer whale has to go learn how to catch it. And as it becomes adept at catching a free swimming seal, it eventually has to learn how to beach itself to grab a seal off the beach. There's an intense learning period that goes on. And when you look at the dynamics of how these groups of killer whales go after prey, oftentimes the adult whales, especially the males, have a tendency to hang out on the periphery and let the younger whales actually go in and do the hunting, the catching. I mean, they're the ones that need to build up their, I almost said chops, but that's not the right word I want to use. They need to build up their expertise to become better predators.
Wow. You know,
it's not
like
a
training school.
Exactly. Exactly. It's amazing to see. And you know, I've seen this in bottlenose dolphins when they, bottlenose dolphins, they feed on fish, and they'll oftentimes chase a school of fish up onto a mud bank. And the dolphins are up there on a mud bank with these fish that are out of water, and the dolphins just lay there on their sides plucking off fish in the mud. You know, and to bring this into a current scenario, this happens in a number of places around the world, but one of the places where I observed it was in the bayous of Louisiana, the same bayous that are now covered with oil. So, you know, not to sound really depressing, but, you know.
Yeah, boy, that's an ecological disaster there. I mean, it's not the biggest oil spill that there has been in modern times. There have been oil spills at 100,000 barrels a day, actually just spilling out on the ground, a gusher that got away. And I've seen photographs of valleys filled with oil, men rowing boats across the valley on the oil. Now, you wouldn't be able to tell it today. It's been 40 years or so, maybe 50 years, or maybe 60 years since that happened. It was in the 30s. You wouldn't know it today because there are subdivisions and parks and all that there, and the oil seeps back into the ground and things go back to normal. But in the ocean, it's quite a bit different because as that oil coagulates and drops to the bottom, it drops onto seabeds of clams and shrimp and lobsters and crab. And you could devastate a population for 20 years, could you not?
Oh, absolutely. It's very easy. And the toxic effects, you know, what it does to the reproductive tracts of mammals, you know, can be absolutely just devastating. So an entire generation of reproductively mature animals cannot successfully reproduce. You know, it's a major problem.
Yeah.
Pollution is one of the real big deals that's likely to affect marine mammals in a much bigger way than it already has in the very near future.
Well, I know we look at these kinds of things primarily in the way that it impacts our society, fishermen and shrimpers and people that do the crabbing off of that area. And that is certainly a tragedy as well. I mean, they're going to have to find other things to do for about a decade. But the real heartbreaker is what does it permanently do to the ecology? As the species that cannot recover from this kind of pollution go extinct, their genetics are eliminated from the pool, only those that can adapt to the change in environment survive, which means that when the population rebounds and it comes back, it's a different population. It has a different kind of nutritive value, habit systems, reproductive systems, a whole screened out gene code. And I think I'm looking at that right, am I not?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. But, you know, with marine mammals, we're looking at animals that can move, and they can move great distances in a short amount of time. And, you know, one of the things is, you know, if there's an event that occurs that, you know, a pollution event that occurs and these big things that can move around leave, as this area begins to recover, they do so without the same suite of these big mobile predators returning. Because these guys, you know, if they can't make a living in one place, they'll go find a place where they can.
Sure.
So, you know, these ecosystems, when they begin to rebound, you know, we're not getting the same ecosystem back. It's
right.
It's changed. It's changed dramatically. And this is one of the things that you know, about the whaling question that really sort of gets to me when asked why whale, the responses by the Japanese is, well, the world is, you know, there's a lot of bad things going on. You know, there's collapses and fish stocks and all this stuff. So what we want to do is restore the earth back into balance. But if you've disturbed the earth and the changes that have occurred, that whatever they are that took place, there's no real balance to restore it to. You know, things are absolutely different. And, you know, the world changes and it, you know, I mean, you can look at it at the world as being imbalanced at some scales, but at other scales, it's absolutely not. There are changes that occur at a number of different temporal scales. But the idea, the that, you know, we're going to go kill whales to return the ocean to its natural healthy state just leaves me baffled.
Yeah, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense. By the way, if you want to join us on the program tonight, the phone number here at X Squared Radio is 415-762-1161, 415-762-1161. Most of the population of Earth lives their entire life on land. Very few of us ever really get out in boats and go out on the ocean. Maybe we might take a cruise, but that's not really the same thing. We're in sea lanes. You've spent most of your life on the water, in small boats, and you've had experiences. What are a couple of the most remarkable experiences that you've had out there with these beings in the water?
One of which that first comes to my mind was I was out in my boat. It was a 17-foot Boston Whaler off of Monterey Bay, and I was looking for minke whales at the time, but I came upon this rather large concentration of blue whales that comes into the area every summer and fall. And a friend of mine has a research permit, which you need to do this, to photograph whales, blue whales and humpback whales, to identify individuals to figure out how many of these different whales there are in this population. So I was helping him out. I was covering it under his permit. And I was just sitting there watching, you know, whales surfacing, you know, a few hundred yards away from me. And all of a sudden, the sea around me turned a different color. It got lighter and it got bluer. And I realized that there was a blue whale underneath me. And I'm in a 17-foot boat, and this is an 80-foot blue whale. And he's maybe 20 feet below me. And he starts, the color starts to get bigger. It's a bigger patch of color, which to me signaled that, oh, he's coming up to the surface. So I moved my boat over, a swell came by, and I sort of surfed away, and the whale surfaced next to me. And he went underwater, and he slid right underneath my boat again and stayed there for 5 minutes and then started his ascent up again. And, you know, the engine on my boat was off. He knew I was there. I kept banging the oar against the hull of my boat as soon as I realized there was a whale underneath me, because I wanted the whale to know that I was above him. So he was aware I was there, and he just kept this up for a long time. It was absolutely amazing.
Ever been in the water with a whale like that and actually looked back and forth at each other? Are they aware of you? Are they curious about you?
Oh, they are absolutely curious. I had the good fortune to go to the Great Barrier Reef in Australia in the wintertime down there, which is the breeding season for baleen whales is wintertime. And so there were was a population of dwarf minke whales that comes to the Great Barrier Reef. And they're very curious animals. In fact, minke whales are one of the more curious whales that you'll find. And they come up to boats, and they come up to divers in the water. And so I was on this boat with a bunch of other people, and what would happen is, as soon as we saw a dwarf minke whale, they would throw ropes over the side. You'd grab a mask, fin, and snorkel. You'd grab onto the rope, and you'd hang there. And whales would come up to you and just look at you, and they'd, you know, they'd swim along this rope, staring at everybody, giving opportunities for great photographs, but also looking at everybody, and you can see the eye staring at you. You know, and you could see the eye moving, you know, looking you up and down like, you know, you would a person, basically.
Now, you're breathing with scuba equipment at this time, or are you just snorkeling?
Just snorkeling. Whales don't seem to really like bubbles. It turns out that bubbles have a meaning to many different types of whales. One of the meanings to whales is that bubbles are an aggressive sign. So
I wouldn't want to be too aggressive to an animal that's 80 feet long and happens to have young around. That might not be a good thing.
Yeah, they aren't really caught into that. I frankly wouldn't want to be blowing bubbles around an animal that's, 8 feet long, even 80 feet, because, they're very fast swimming, and they're, and you're just a slug in the water compared to them.
Yeah, I reckon so.
But to have these ants actually go out of their way, they have appointments to keep, or whatever minke whales do or whatever blue whales do with their time. But they take time out of their day to come up and look at you. And it's not just for 5 minutes or 10 minutes. But they've had encounters at the Great Barrier Reef with the same individual whales for 5 hours.
Oh, my goodness.
12 hours.
So, they live a long time. They're a very patient animal, and they want to take a good look at you. I guess a good look could take that long.
Well, they're patient, and they're curious. And, with minke whales, it turns out this curiosity is a bad thing. It is actually used against them in Norway, where one of the main tactics for hunting minke whales in Norway is where the catcher boat will just either motor very, very slowly or stop and leave its motor running. And in either case, minke whales are very curious. They come up to these boats and swim around them. And as soon as the whale swims around the bow of the boat where the harpoon is located, the whale gets shot.
Wow.
So this curiosity is fun for some of us, but it's a terrible opportunity for others, it turns out. So.
Well, I hope the word doesn't spread too far. I want them to maintain their childlike curiosity as long as possible. One of my other friends who has reportedly explored the world of whales, maybe not in total compliance with sea law, was diving with some whales off the coast of Cuba one time and noticed that these large whales had pointed their heads straight down at the bottom of the ocean, which, by the way, was a couple thousand feet down. And these whales were only about 40 or 50 feet down. But these whales kind of went into a meditative state where they just stayed there at that level, pointing down, moving very slowly, but they were like toning to the earth, almost like a chorus of whales. And she said they were in kind of a meditative state. Do you know what they might have been doing at that time in that state?
Well, first thing, that law again, that where it's against the law to get in the water with a whale, that's a U.S. law. It's against federal law to do that. So off Cuba, she was fine. And do you know what kind of whales they were?
I don't remember. I honestly don't. I know they were big. They were like maybe blue whales or humpback whales. I just don't know which ones are indigenous to that area.
It may have been humpback whales, and if it was indeed humpback whales, this head-down position is a position that male humpback whales take when they're singing. And if she was hearing sounds at the same time, it could very well have been, either one or more of these whales stopping, pointing the head down, and singing. And they sing these just elaborate, fabulous songs. I mean, record albums have been made. CDs have been made, showing my age there, with the songs of humpback whales. And so that's maybe what she was experiencing. But
she said that the feeling that overcame her, because she was in the water, so some of these vibrations were very low frequency, actually vibrated through her body, and she really felt the emotion of what they were doing.
Oh, absolutely. These sounds are loud. They are incredibly loud. And some of the lower frequencies contain a whole bunch of power. And what happens, what people have experienced when they get in the water with a humpback whale or one of these large whales that's making these loud, low-frequency sounds is that you hear the sound although our hearing underwater isn't really very good. We can't hear. But you feel the sound. And what's happening is these sound waves, these powerful sound waves, are vibrating air spaces in our bodies. And that's the feeling that you get. And it's you know, so it's like your intestines and your stomach. You feel it sometimes in your joints as well. And it's a real amazing feeling. And so you're feeling almost like a harmonic vibration with the sounds that they're making, because those air spaces are vibrating at the same frequency of the sounds that they're making.
That really sounds incredible. I wonder, you know, if are they singing for amusement, or do they sing as part of a ritual? Are they this kind of social being that they like to get together and sing together?
Well, I have several friends that have studied the sound, the song of the humpback whale, and it's not really clear why they sing, but there's a few ideas out there. One of which is that since it is males that are singing, that these males sing to attract the females. You know, if I can sing better than that guy over there, whatever woman, female, is in the area, you know, is going to hear my great song and come swimming over, you know, and, you know, good for me. Another idea is that these songs are used kind of like the antlers or the horns of an ungulate. You know, males use these horns to fight against each other. And it could be that these songs are used, you know, as in place of fighting. You know, I'm a better singer than you are. No, you're not, because here's my song, and my song's better than you. And it's kind of a way of it's a show, and you're trying to get the other guy to back down. Humpback whales, however, you know, they're called the gentle giants of the sea by a lot of people, but they're anything but that. Because males will be very physically aggressive with one another for access to a female. They'll smack each other with their flippers, with their tails. They'll jump on top of each other. They'll ram each other. If you ever look at the head of a humpback whale, they have these bumps on them. And sometimes associated with these bumps are barnacles. And the whales will scrape the top of their barnacle-laden snouts against the side or the head of a competitor. And they'll leave these big scrape marks, and, you know, it's a bloody fight sometimes. And there was a whale that was killed during a very aggressive male-male interaction. Sometimes several males are vying for the attention of a single female. So it's they're quite violent. But the function of these songs, you know, the last I heard is it's not really clear what these songs are used for. But whatever they're used for, they're quite beautiful. The whales will sing them over and over again. You know, the song will last an hour, and then the whale will stop singing and start up again. End the song and start singing again. You know, and if you can imagine yourself being a sailor on one of the old wooden-hulled sailing ships, to be sailing through tropical waters where baleen whales do most of their mating, you know, and to hear this sound of these humpback whales singing, vibrating through the hull of your ship, especially,
wow.
You know, it must be, you know, an amazing thing to encounter, to hear.
Wow. Well, we have about 6 minutes left. I want to cover one more thing, and that's dolphins really quickly. Dolphins have also a very good social structure, very fast swimmers, and they can feed themselves in a pretty short order out at sea. What do they do with the rest of their time? I mean, do they sleep? Do they play? What is it? How is their lifestyle?
Well, they spend a lot of their time playing. They will swim together. They'll chase each other around. And they do this while they're moving from one place to another. There's also places where these dolphins will go to rest, to especially if there's young animals with them. They'll seek out sheltered waters where there's a small chance of running into a predator. And so the offspring can rest. Off of Hawaii, for example, spinner dolphins, which are dolphins that you can see very close to shore of the big island of Hawaii, as well as Maui and other islands, they spend their nights offshore in the deep waters feeding on squid that come up towards the surface at night. And then during the day, they come into shore to rest. But they do spend a lot of time playing, and they spend a lot of time engaged in mating behaviors.
They're romantic animals just for fun?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, yeah, they're often rubbing against each other and, touching each other. And it's quite amazing. They seem, when they're swimming in a group underwater, they seem to be almost constantly in touch with one another, physically. They spend a lot of time, having sex, it seems
having
like.
Sex. Yeah, having sex for fun. So there you go.
We have the big brains, right?
Sentient animals don't have to just have sex for procreation. They can also have sex for affection with one another.
Well, they're very tactile. Dolphins in captivity, they do like to be touched. They do like that contact. And you watch them in the wild. Same with killer whales. They're very tactile.
Wow, fascinating. I could go on for hours with this, but we do have another guest coming on in about 5 minutes. Jonathan, it's an amazing pleasure. I feel like I'm at sea with you when you're telling me these stories. I really enjoy having you on the program.
Oh, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here with you and talking about this.
You have a website where the book is available and where some of your studies can be reviewed by our listeners?
Yeah, it's BayAreaMinkeyWhale.org. I couldn't come up with a longer name than that.
That's M-I-N-K-E for the Minke Whale. BayAreaMinkeyWhale.org or .com?
.org.
.org. Very, very good. Yeah. All right, Jonathan, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for coming on the program, and we'll be in touch another time.
Great. Look forward to it. Take care of yourselves.
Thank you very much. Good evening.
You too. Bye-bye.
All right, Earth Explorers, we will take a very quick 5-minute break, and we will be here with our next guest, Stephen Bassett. You've heard about the Disclosure Project. Well, we're going to find out what's going on. There are some updates and some remarkable finds. We'll be back in about 4.5 minutes with more X Squared Radio after this. And welcome back to Hour 2 of X Squared Radio. And just before we get started, I want to interject just a little bit of Rumi here. A story, a mouse caught hold of a camel's lead rope in his two forelegs and walked off with it, imitating the camel's drivers. The camel went along, letting the mouse feel heroic. Enjoy yourself, he thought. I have something to teach you presently. They came to the edge of a great river. The mouse was dumbfounded. Step forward into the river. You are my leader. Don't stop here. I'm afraid of being drowned, said the mouse. The camel walked into the water. It's only just above the knee. Your knee is 100 times over my head. Well, maybe you shouldn't be leading a camel. So as I interject that story, I just want to send President Obama a message. Maybe you're in a little over your head, Mr. President. Why don't you let those that know what they're doing lead from here? I want to let you know my new book, Remembering the Future, went to press today. So hopefully in about less than 4 weeks, you're going to be able to have this in your hands. Remembering the Future, the Physics of the Soul and Time Travel. If you bought the ebook, you will be sent an email with a coupon code for 25% off the printed version. I think you're going to enjoy it. It just came through editing, and it's a very, very good book. RememberingTheFutureBook.com if you want to pick up the ebook now. Also, remember, Twitter is alive and well on X Squared Radio, and I add stuff all day as we approach the announcement of the Inner Earth Expedition and other things like the nation's first affordable electric vehicles. So keep track of me on Twitter by searching for Brooks Agnew. And don't forget to click on the Web Talk Radio link at X Squared Radio. It's a short 30-minute version of the program, free for everyone to listen to. The more you click and the more friends you send there, the better our chances for syndication. That means we get to play on the airwaves. So let's spread the word, because we need to get something positive going out there. We'll be back in 40 seconds with our next guest. We'll talk about the Disclosure Project on X Squared Radio. For more than 60 years, Americans have been petitioning the United States government to release what it knows about UFOs. In recent years, Canada, France, and other nations have come forth declassifying their documents and releasing a plethora of facts and figures and evidence and video and pictures to the public. It's about time the U.S. government did so, and leading the effort to do this is my friend Stephen Bassett. Welcome to the program, Stephen.
It's great to be with you, Brooks, as always.
I have heard a lot going on in the news, Stephen, and we've been watching the Disclosure Project very closely for a number of years, and this is a work of passion. It is definitely not a work of great revenue, and you're certainly not making any money at it, but it is a passion of faith and dedication to the revelation of truth to the American people. So tell us what's happened in the last 12 months or so.
Well, first, let me, and this happens all the time, so don't think anything about it, but I'm a political, extra-political activist, and I'm involved in the disclosure movement. The Disclosure Project is, in fact, a formal organization by Stephen Greer. And I'm often confused. He and I often get confused. No big deal. Happens all the time. But I always clarify, because otherwise it can, you know, can snowball. The disclosure process, of course, continues. And it has only one outcome, and that is the governments of the world will acknowledge the ET presence. They haven't got any choice, really. the activism itself is important, and you're right. You simply cannot pursue this kind of thing as a business. You can't pursue it as a lifestyle. You are in, and this is true of all activist movements that I've studied, almost no exceptions. I think that, you know, there are certain kinds of causes that are pursued by movie stars and rock stars, and they're able to do some good, and they also live very well, but this is generally not common. Activist movements, particularly the great social movements of our times, require a certain approach that you simply, you know, buy into, and you can't have it both ways. I happen to think that the disclosure movement is the most important activist movement in history, more important than the civil rights movement, women's rights movement, suffrage, the colonial independence from colonialism. Pick it. And I make that statement, Brooks, based upon the scope of the issue, the implications of the issue, how many people are going to be affected by its resolution, virtually everyone globally. No movement really in any issue has ever had this depth and breadth, though ironically, because of the truth embargo that's been in place, that is not the perception amongst the general people, general public rather, and that sort of creates an interesting cognitive dissonance.
Well, let's cover a couple of those aspects. You know, and, oh, what was it, 10, 15 years ago, the Brookings Institute institution came out and made a statement, or at least released a study, that said if global first contact were to occur, or if the United States were to release everything that it knew about UFOs, that there would be a socio-religious collapse of our society. Do you think that's still true today, that that would happen?
Actually, I don't think it was true then. Everything that's happened since 1947 has been part of an orchestrated government policy, which I have come to call the truth embargo, replacing what it generally been the term had been the UFO cover-up. But that term did not properly describe it. And so the policy of truth embargo has been around 60 years, and everything that's happened, been done, been said, is all within the context of that truth embargo. And in general, the rule is nothing is what it seems. Just, it's like Alice in Wonderland. Nothing is what it seems. Which makes for a rather interesting history, and a very confusing, you know, reality, which is not helpful because reality is already pretty confusing.
Coming into the mainstream, we're not talking about fringe stuff anymore. I mean, just recently you were on Fox News with Shepard Smith, and you went over the military footage where ships of light were actually caught on film by military jets, and that was released to the news. So we're not talking about fringe anymore. We're talking about mainstream withholding of evidence from the American people that we are not alone.
Well, this is the historical dynamic. You see, in 1960, when the Brookings Report was issued, it was commissioned by the Navy. It was primarily a propaganda maneuver. What they were trying to do there was to come up with a sort of cover story for dealing with all of the people inside government, military agencies, intelligence agencies, and others, who, one way or another, were going to figure out the ET issue was real. And they needed to keep them in line. They obviously had non-disclosure agreements, and they were under classification regimens and all that. But still, that doesn't mean they couldn't just decide to go run down to the New York Times like Daniel Ellsberg with a whole bunch of files on any given day. And so in order to help them do that, they come up with this idea of, oh, look, and let it kind of get out there. And also in the public's mind, too, is kind of a dampener that, oh, if this becomes true, and by 1960, plenty of people knew it was true. I mean, the sightings had been all over the place, and a lot had already happened. But if this becomes true, it'll be the end of civilization, the end of religion, the end of finance, and blah, 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 blah. In other words, don't run down to the New York Times like Daniel Ellsberg. You'll end civilization, which is fairly, you know, strong medicine. okay, well and good. Now, in 1952, 8 years earlier, in late 52, the Robertson panel was commissioned. And in that panel, what they did was outline a policy that basically said, look, the ET issue isn't that much of a problem. It is the presence of them is not that much of a problem yet, but the public's awareness of it is a problem, and so we have got to manage the public's awareness. And so this, you know, whether, what would happen to society if the truth were revealed, no one has ever really fully addressed. What we have gotten is manipulation and propaganda and lies, and so there is no academic understanding of this. There is no solid understanding because the government has spent billions of dollars to ensure that we don't have that. Now,
well,
today,
listen to how they've done that, too. I mean, they have fed information to the science fiction community, which has made movies and all kinds of documentaries to kind of soften up society, but also to mislead them, to send them down another road of understanding.
Oh, they did everything. This was a brilliantly conceived effort that was very difficult to achieve, but they were successful. The CIA founded the National Enquirer. It founded the Weekly World News. It used them to plant stories about lots of things, particularly the UFO question. They planted journalists, CIA-backed journalists, on virtually every major paper in the country, the networks. They have gone to great lengths to manage our perceptions, with the UFO ET issue being number one on the list, and not the only thing on the list. And this kind of benign propaganda maneuver, ostensibly for national security reasons, to save us and protect us from grave dangers, has simply run its course. And as you pointed out, the issue, by sheer weight of the evidence and the endless sightings and witnesses and everything else, is now mainstreaming very rapidly. And so, you know, the Brookings Report is out the door, the Robertson panel is out the door, the Conan Report, the Project Blue Book, throw it all out. We are in a new time now. And this embargo is falling apart. It's got leaks. It's frayed. The foundation is crumbling. It's a mess. And it's really kind of stumbling forward on its own momentum. And now what's at stake is not whether the embargo lasts or not. What's at stake is how well various governments are perceived by their citizens in dealing with this issue in the modern era. Not what they did in 1950 or 60 or 70 or 80, but how did they handle the run-up to disclosure and the post-disclosure period? And first and foremost, who is going
Steve,
to end this truth embargo?
Steve, we're really
talking
about.
And so we see Obama stumbling forward here, having a very, very tough time.
We're talking
in Europe,
about two different aspects
in the UK,
of it.
So there's new leadership there that's very interesting. We see countries releasing files by the tens of thousands of records. We see witnesses coming forward. There's a lot of confusion, but ultimately, one nation is going to act. And the four most likely candidates are, actually, I think I will go with five here. They are Russia, China, Brazil, France, and now I'm adding the UK. And the reason I'm adding the UK, which I had not included for a good while, is because of the change of government there. So now, any one of these five nations
in our country, Steve, we have basically two layers of government. We have the public government that we elect and that we see on TV, we can watch on C-SPAN and the news. And then we have the unelected government. We have sort of the bureaucratic government, the under the scenes, behind the curtain government that runs all the money. Now, how's the movement for amnesty for those folks? If they come forth now, are we going to publicly start having congressional hearings, or are we going to give them some kind of amnesty that they can come forward and say, yes, we have a warehouse full of Roswell spacecraft and we're now ready to show them to you?
The amnesty issue for witnesses has been out there for decades. It's not going to happen, but it was worth doing. In other words, if any amnesty is given to people to come forward, to speak about their experiences with ET UFO issue while working for the government and working under clearances. It will happen in the post-disclosure world, not pre-disclosure. It's not going to happen.
Sure.
However, it was
sure,
very
I
important
believe.
To put that out there. And we did many times, going all the way back in the early 90s. And the reason why it was important was to send a message to those inside that we don't want to view the government as the enemy, and we don't want to view them as the enemy, and we are going to be very understanding and sympathetic to those who have had to go along with this truth embargo because it's their job and because they were told it was in the interest of national security. In other words,
sure,
we're sending a message
sure.
of understanding and reconciliation ahead of the game. It's kind of a presumptive close in a way, but what we're saying is, look, and certainly we're saying we will support amnesty after disclosure. I mean, that's a given. I mean, when it comes up, we're going to be there. But there is no way that amnesty would be instituted prior to disclosure because that would end the truth embargo virtually overnight. And so we sort of knew that. I mean, what you have to think about this, Brooks, is an extremely complex four-dimensional chess game. It's not a three-dimensional chess game because the truth embargo creates kind of an additional dimension to all this that doesn't exist under activist movements. I mean, the civil rights movement never had to prove there was segregation in the South. The independence movement in India never had to prove that the British were there. The women who were trying to get the right to vote never had to prove that they were being denied the right to vote. But in the disclosure movement, we are repeatedly asked over and over and over again to prove the fundamental premise. Disclosure of ETs? What ETs? How do you know they're ETs? This makes it a four-dimensional chess game, and it's extremely complicated and very difficult for people to follow, which is why it's been very hard to build what we call a mass movement until just recently it's starting to take hold, and almost impossible to get funding because we're operating in uncharted waters that people are not familiar with and not comfortable with.
Well, let's talk about funding for a moment. You know, recently the budgets for the U.S. government were released, and we noticed a little bit of disparity here. One was $170 million for the annual budget for NASA. On the other hand, national defense was $1.3 trillion. Trillion with a T. Now, as far as I know, Stephen, we have some small skirmishes. We have a couple of police actions. We're fighting terror. But we're not really in a full-scale Navy-to-Navy, Air Force-to-Air Force, Army-to-Army war right now. And then add to that the fact that the U.S. Air Force took over the X-37B program, which the NASA had just about given up, which was an unmanned robotic miniature space shuttle. The Air Force puts it on its rapid deployment program, loads it with the most classified weapon system, so classified no one even knows what's on board, does not disclose the budget, and then launches the spacecraft on a 9-month mission and is going to follow it up with some more of them. What's going on with weaponizing space?
Well, one of the most important exopolitical questions that will eventually be answered, but it's been asked, but not in the mainstream, because, well, I don't know what the mainstream media does anymore, frankly, though they are getting better with this issue, bless their heart, is that 10 years after the Cold War was won and Russia steeped itself in capitalism and all the KGB has went out and, you know, started corporations, and the U.S. was, in a sense, preeminent. Our defense budget exceeded the sum of all defense budgets in the world of all other nations. This is around 2000. I think it's still the case, but it's fluctuated. It fluctuates a little bit. But in other words, our defense budget is greater than all the other nations in the world combined. And the exopolitical question was, who are we defending ourselves against? And the answer to that question needs to be made pretty quickly. Again, getting back to what I said before, that nothing is what it seems. Nothing the government says about the space program is what it seems, is what it really is. No actions they take is really what's going on. The information they release is not probative. Their policies with respect to weaponization, never disclosed, not properly understood. This is, again, a massive chess game being played by an incredibly powerful, very well-funded intelligence operation, all within what I call the secret empire. And it's being driven by...
That doesn't have anything to do with the White House, right? I mean, the White House isn't in charge of this. They're not running that.
Well, this is one of the great issues that has to be resolved. This is another one of the major exopolitical issues, turns out. It's not all exopolitical. Is that our government really has three fundamental layers, in looking across the whole thing. One is what we'll call the purely elected layer. It's the president, it's the members of Congress and their immediate staff. Let's stay out of the state area, because overall it's not that really relevant to this. That's the first layer. The second layer is what we'll call the above-ground bureaucracy. These are all of the people, civil servants, a lot of long-time appointees, people that are not elected at all, that are involved in the vast operations of government, and they are huge. They are in the hundreds and hundreds of thousands, if not millions. And they operate under a certain sort of set of protocols. And then there is third layer, and that is, of course, the secret empire. Often mistakenly referred to as the shadow government, second government. That's not what it is. The secret empire is, as I've said many times, the sum totality of the all of the intelligence classified operations pertaining to U.S. governance. And that includes all of the main intelligence agencies, all of the intelligence offices within the military services. It includes the entire classified operations amongst all corporate corporations, obviously mostly defense contractors. It includes all of the classified people, all of the classified documents, all of the classified programs, all the facilities, both in space, on the ground, and underground. It is huge. It is being funded by money above black, in the black, and also what we call lobe funding, which is beyond black. It's off the charts. The amount is unknown. Since 1947, it is in the many trillions of dollars. And this layer is interesting. There's several things about it. One, that are notable. One, it is essentially kind of detached itself from the first layer, which is this, it's like a pod separation, you know, in Star Trek, where, you know, the first level of government, the elected level is the pod, and the secret empire is, detached itself from that. And essentially, the President of the United States, the executive branch, and the Congress have less and less to do, and in many cases nothing to do, with what goes on there. And the actual oversight of the secret empire is negligible to the point of nothing. In other words, it is a self-regulated entity. Now, the second thing that's notable about it is not a shadow government. There's not a group of guys down there who are passing laws or instituting state policy, really. And the third thing that's notable is that the vast majority of people working in the secret empire are patriots. They're good Americans. They have families. They go home. They watch cable. They drink beer. They go to the World Series games. They're just like us. But when they go to their job, they step down into the secret empire. Now, there are people, we believe, who literally work below ground and never come up above ground. And so whatever life they have is down there. But even that has probably got a lot of normalcy to it. These people believe they're doing the right thing. They believe they're defending the United States' national security interest. And I can assure you that in many of the cases, they believe that defense involves our dealing with the extraterrestrial issue. So you have a situation here where we have these three layers. And the American people, with very, you know, maybe one person in 100 of American citizens has a reasonable, even reasonable understanding of these dichotomies. They just don't understand it.
Do you feel, in your opinion, in your experience as an exopolitical activist, that sure, we're treating it as a secret government. We're treating it as a secret empire. Our people go underground, and they don't speak about what they do. It's highly classified. We don't know where the money goes. We don't know what it's spent on. We don't know if we have bases on the moon or if we make regular trips to Mars. But do the ETs hold to that? Are they concerned about contact with the American people and those that are involved in that conscious movement? Or are they working in secret with this secret empire, which I assume is multinational?
Well, if the ETs would return my phone calls or emails, I might be able to answer that question, but they never do. The secret empire that I refer to is the one in the U.S. Now, most of the major nations in the world have their own intelligence operations. None of them are in the vast scope of the U.S. But they're not trivial, particularly the U.K., obviously China, and Russia, and India, too. And one of the things that's also notable about this structure that I've discussed is that there is a certain amount of communication that goes on between these operations. In other words, remember we made such a big deal back in the Cuban Missile Crisis about the fact that they installed a phone because the teletexts were a little slow and they were afraid they might have a nuclear war? Trust me, we've moved way past that. And so it's possible for the secret components of the U.S. Intelligence to talk with the secret components of the Chinese, secret components of the Russian, secret components of the U.K. And so there's like a whole other dialogue going on down there. We have no idea what's being said. Now, are they formulating state policy? I'm not so sure. The secret empire is about programs. It's about research. It's about putting bases. It's about the secret space fleet. It's about, you know, antimatter research and on and on and on. It's also about some covert operations. It's about certain tasks that are assigned to it. It's not about what we'll call the hidden governance. Now, there may be an above-ground hidden governance of another type where you have extremely wealthy, you know, multinational bankers who meet secretly and do a lot to affect geopolitical policies. I can't speak to that. I leave that to others. But the secret empires I'm talking about are primarily steeped in the national security structures, and they desperately need to be reformed because intentions are good, but these vast complexes with so little oversight operating in a highly compartmental fashion where one group over here has no idea what another group's doing over here, the recipe there is for disaster. This is not what the founders wanted. In fact, the founders of the United States hadn't the slightest idea that anything of this scope could ever happen. This is so far beyond even their rather brilliant minds. They just couldn't see it coming, and so they did not really provide in the Constitution the necessary tools to deal with it, which is another reason why it is so huge and it's become such a problem.
This is kind of the way I
approach all this, Brooks, in order to play this chess game that we're talking about.
Is the secret government consorting with off-world sources of technology or, as it were, a social engineering in order to make this profitable for them? Or are we just looking at the clear or the sovereign airspace of Earth and more particularly the United States and protecting that airspace from incursion by off-world craft or even craft that have been here for a long time? We don't necessarily call them terrestrial craft, but they're certainly not from our neighborhood. So are we talking about just defense of our airspace or are we actively trading technology with these groups?
We don't know. I mean, we simply don't know. And the government wants it that way. As the internet developed, as the research developed, as more people got involved, we got little pieces of the puzzle. Think of the whole reality of the human race and the Earth right now is a billion piece puzzle that once put together gives us a stark and clear picture of everything. We have a tiny percentage of those pieces scattered around on a very large table, and we're stepping back from it, trying to figure out what the picture is.
Now, that's a good point.
We do have some skills, and we do have the internet, and so you have an enormous effort to try to quote, fill in the missing pieces, and the internet has really made that possible. More importantly, the government is constantly, well, it less so now, but it was putting out all kinds of misinformation, and it was throwing phony pieces onto the table to ensure that we could just never get a clear picture. And so
there were also those that were taking advantage of our great interest in this, and they were fabricating facts and fabricating their involvement with the facts for their own gain, which I'm sure is a great amusement to the government.
You had people putting out false information to sell books. You had people that were subcontractors of the government. You had direct. So in other words, you know, if the truth is the first casualty of war, it's also the first casualty of secrecy. And so what has happened is the American people have been fed so much propaganda since 1947 that they have lost faith in government. And this accelerated during the Vietnam War, and from that point forward, particularly after the Nixon scandal, from that point forward, you had a country in which a very significant portion of the people in it had essentially put the social contract in a drawer and shut the drawer. And they didn't trust, they didn't believe, they were operating from a high degree of skepticism, and when that happens, the social structures start to break down. It's like a marriage. The husband and the wife will be able to run a pretty good family if they have fundamental trust in each other. They believe what each other is saying, and they can depend on each other. And if that trust breaks down to a point, the family completely comes apart. And that's what started happening in the U.S. And as the years went forward, the effect of that breakdown of the social contract was an ever-increasing inability of the U.S. to get anything done. Without the trust of the American people, without a certain fundamental agreement under that social contract, things weren't going to get done. In 1,000 different ways, you needed a bridge, you didn't get it. You needed a social program, it didn't happen. You need physical responsibility, it didn't take place. You needed this, you needed that. You needed regulation of the bank industry, it wasn't going to happen. You didn't want to go into a war, you went anyway. And on and on and on. And slowly, the United States has been doing an excellent job of essentially undoing its relatively strong run from 1770s to about 1975. And if we continue down the road we are going to virtually destroy the country. So
yeah, I see that patriotism fraying at the edges right now. I mean, I look at the case of the Prime Minister in Canada, where he recently took to the news and volunteered that he spoke to President Clinton and said, when are you going to release this information? And now this is the Prime Minister or the Minister of Defense for Canada coming back and saying, Bill Clinton said, there are two governments, one inside the other, and I don't run it.
This is a, I'm familiar with this story. This is a clouded story, but essentially, Paul Hellyer was referring to a story conveyed to him through Stephen Greer, and that story was conveyed to Greer from Sarah McClendon. And it goes back to the Rockefeller Initiative of 93 to 96, when Clinton was seriously entertaining ending the truth embargo, but was blocked at every turn. And in fact, not just blocked, he was savaged. I mean, they brought the wrath of God down. So again, part of an extremely complex history that we could spend weeks discussing, but let's bring your audience into the moment now. Here's where we are in 2010. For the last 10 years, going back to 2000, one country after another has been breaking ranks with the UFO truth embargo policy. They haven't ended the truth embargo, but they have clearly taken actions which show publicly that they are less inclined with each year to go along with it. I'm sure they are saying things in the background on their back channels, but you know the U.S. can just ignore that. By taking public actions, they are also putting pressure on the U.S. And of course, I refer to the Cometa report issued out of France in 1999, and of course, all of the files that started getting released in 2004 and forward by France, U.K., Australia, Canada, Uruguay, Denmark, Sweden, yada, 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 yada. And, of course, major developments in Brazil. These countries are breaking ranks. That's the first thing. Secondly, the number of witnesses that keep coming forward is continuing. And so every year they have a few more people who have worked and done good work for the government who are coming forward and saying, look, I know this thing is real. I know the ETs are real. I did this. I saw this. This is making it tougher. Thirdly, the accumulation of bad governance worldwide, going back 100 years, which didn't end with the end of World War II, I can assure you. failure to address just about every major issue on the planet, from population to disease to the poor nations, the overall human condition, to pollution of the oceans, pollution of the atmosphere, warming issues, which may very well be by the sun, doesn't matter. If you're underwater, you're underwater, and on and on and on. Not to mention the rise of terrorism, which is a fundamental outgrowth of the disparity between the rich and the poor in the world. The poor are not simply going to go lie down and die. They're going to put up a hell of a fight, and they're going to cause all kinds of havoc. And so we have let everything go to the point where we're now facing a whole plethora of tipping points, and we're up against the wall.
And they well, I understand that. I understand the pressures of the masses and the poor and the hungry and the disenfranchised. But those aren't the individuals that are going to take to the air with sophisticated aircraft and make left-hand turns at 10,000 miles an hour, mocking our most advanced, you know, methods of flying. Somebody is flying craft up there by the tens of thousands every single month, and they're flying circles around anything that we've got. And they're not from around here, and if they are, that's even more profound.
It's not clear that they're a threat, and the government has actually said that on several occasions. The danger is us, Brooks. Right now, the biggest thing you need to worry about is not ETs, it's human beings. Human beings are about to take this world apart and turn it into a cosmic waste dump. So I don't know what the ETs' intentions are, but I know that this gathering storm of political and governing failure has put the human races back against the wall. And so this is another thing putting enormous pressure on the truth embargo. We cannot go forward unless we start first renewing trust in government, which means the government of the world got to get in the truth business. Lying as an institutional process isn't going to work anymore, particularly with the Internet. They get caught all the time now. I mean, you know, they'll issue a lie at 8 o'clock on Monday morning, and by noon, it's all been completely found out, and they're making their apologies by 1 p.m. It doesn't work anymore, and the people are fed up with it. Secondly, we have to know, I mean, given what we face, knowing that we're not alone in the universe may be rather profoundly helpful to 6 billion people trying to, quote, find their way, trying to assess what they want to do next, blow myself up, go to war, pollute the Pacific, whatever. I think it's important they know the truth of the world that they're in, right? Like a guy should know whether he's dying of cancer or not so he knows how to spend his last days, or how to go and cure it, you see. If you're not told by your doctor you have cancer, you can't go get treatment for it. And so this is a pretty important issue. And then thirdly, it's obvious from a considerable amount of evidence that whether or not we are in any kind of what we'll call formal arrangements with extraterrestrials, we have got extraterrestrial technology. The evidence for that, I think, is now overwhelming and compelling. We've had ET technology for a very long time. It is sequestered within the national security structure. It has been under development for decades. It is not available for you. It's not available for me. It's not available for the poor. It is available for weaponization, national security.
Well, that's what I see. Most of this technology, if it's being reverse engineered, it's propulsion technology, it's energy technology, it's communication technology, but it's driven by defense dollars. It's not driven by energy. It's not driven by food or survival or disease control or population control. It's driven by weaponization.
It's driven by national security agendas, which need to be reassessed. It's part of a vast secret empire that needs to be reformed. We are dealing with huge structural momentum here. When you build something as big as a secret empire, it's basically like having a billion-ton aircraft carrier. Try turning that thing, right, on a dime. And so, you know, we built it. Now we've got to, quote, restructure it, right, or we're going to sail right off the edge of the world. So it's a pretty dire situation in some respects, and yet it's filled with enormous promise because disclosure immediately informs the world that there are multiple civilizations throughout the galaxy. Two, it informs the world that we have extraordinary technology which could be brought to bear very quickly and possibly alter the social, political, human condition equations that we're facing and actually make us feel like we can solve some of them. 3, it means we may be able to go to the stars very soon, right? 4, we might be then in a position to have open contact with ETs, which theoretically, unless the ETs definitely mean us harm, may expose us to more additional and profound new technologies. Now, this is actually one of the interesting themes in the TIA television show V. Now, of course, the whole thing has been molded into a us versus them diabolical, you know, hidden reptilian thing, because that's what sells and gets ratings. But the concept is there.
Let me put this by you. You know, all of the things that you brought up have economic value. Things like clean energy, which would definitely head off things like what we've got going on in the Gulf right now. Air pollution, clean water, interstellar travel, interplanetary population. It seems like all of these pathways contain within them an unlimited future and profit. But weapons have no profit to them. The only thing they do is kill people and break things, and nobody pays for that.
I understand the dichotomy there, but it's more complex than that, folks.
It sounds to me like the mouse is
a very significant number of people right now in government want this over. They want this truth embargo to end. And they do see the great promise that this transition would rapidly bring for the world, and they want it to end. But there are also those in there who still adhere to a very strong national security posture. They are still worried about the Chinese nuclear weapons. And I imagine there are definitely people inside government making relatively cogent and strong cases for why we simply cannot assume, over, say, a reasonable period of time, not super long term, but near term, that the ETs or a new ET species could arrive that would be a threat. And so,
all the more reason why we should learn to live as Earthlings instead of nations poised against one another.
Nationalism is going to go away anytime soon, and why we definitely need to come together as a species. I can assure you that the difference between that modality and, say, a planet of 220 nations won't make that much difference. Advanced species that have gone interstellar are an overwhelmingly formidable foe, and we cannot prevail against them. I've heard a few people try to make the case, but it doesn't even get close.
We'd be rubbing two sticks together to make fire before no time.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many ways they could destroy us, it's not even funny. So, now, again, working within this incomplete picture that I was talking about, trying to make assessments based upon a very incomplete and deliberately muddied history and understanding, still, given that we are trying to engage the issue, we still have to make some statements. I will say this, that logically, the most significant defense that we have as a fledgling, almost spacefaring, nearly spacefaring species is the good intentions of collections or collectives of non-terrestrial civilizations. And it's not that complicated. The number one thing, I mean, the principally in our global reality, within the 200 and some countries that exist now, the principal thing that prevents any one of those countries from going completely berserk and starting to nuke other countries and take them over or commit wholesale genocide is the collective will of most of the rest of the nations. In other words, you can't do that. We outnumber you, 100 nations to 1. Now, obviously, it's not quite that simple, but it's pretty much along those lines. And so if we're here, the fact that we're here at all, probably, in my view, giving my best understanding guess, is that there is a collection of civilizations out there that are in the collection and collectively powerful enough to ensure that no individual galactic or rather extraterrestrial civilization can come in here and lay waste to this planet.
I believe that too. If we're reverse engineering ET technology, then that means that ETs have visited us, have exchanged with us in some ways. They are fascinated with us. They're even involved with us. And I believe that too, that we have allies out there. But I would think that our allies would be in shorter number if we continue down this warlike path.
I appreciate the sentiment, but I think the ETs probably have a much broader view. They have been through this before, Brooke. And again, I'm giving you my, best assessment. I'm sure that, they're not unfamiliar with this process where a sentient species gets a hold of the atom and gets a hold of fusion and fission and quantum mechanics. I mean, this has all happened before. This is pretty much, it's the same laws of physics throughout the galaxy, at least as far as I know. And so this is not new to them. And they probably even kind of know the outcome, not because they can look into the future, but because they know how this tends to go. And that there's some kind of a process underway, which is a birthing process, a coming-of-age process. And exactly how involved they are, I don't know. How formal their relationships are with government, I don't know. I know that we have crash vehicles. I'm pretty sure about that. So we have technology that way. Whether we've been given any, I don't know. But the situation we're in now is their presence is quite manifest. They haven't gone away. The awareness is growing exponentially. The efforts by our own governments to withhold this is falling apart. And so it's clearly coming to a head. And my job as an activist is not to get too involved with the thousands of backstories that are out there that are only partially known and try to resolve them somehow. It's not doable. My job is to help ensure that disclosure happens. Right?
Well,
exactly.
I feel like you do that disclosure is firmly on that path toward evolution as a global society.
Of course. Of course. It's like we had to know that we weren't, that we weren't the center of the universe. We had to know that the Earth went around the sun. We had to know the Earth was round. Not knowing those things would have been a significant impediment to our advancing as a complex species. This is not rocket science. And we're going to have to know that we're not alone. And believe me, all of those things pale in comparison to our becoming self-aware of the fact that we are not alone in the universe. This is the preeminent moment in our time as a species. It is the preeminent moment. I speak as a secular person with all respect to the religious moments that have taken place. This is the big one, and what happens next is going to be the great story. And we are going to play a role in it. I mean, this is what's so cool. This is all very personal. Everybody in the planet's going to be participating in the post-disclosure world. They're all going to be affected by the post-disclosure world. And because of the internet, a good deal of them are going to have a say about the post-disclosure world. We are literally going to reshape this planet, how we think, where we go, what we do, in profound ways. Operating in the most collective fashion that our species has ever operated. With all due respect to the Bilderbergers and the Illuminati and the Rothschilds and the Bohemian Grove and the Skull and Bones Boys and everything else, we are moving toward collective power in the world. And that is being demonstrated on a daily basis, though we're hardly, all the way there yet. So this is a big deal. And one of the biggest problems I have is conveying that. It's like standing next to a mountain right up against the sheer cliff with somebody and trying to explain to them how big the mountain is. It's very hard to do.
Yeah, I kind of saw that a little bit. And then they give you, 2 minutes or 3 minutes on Fox News. At least Shepard Smith kind of got out of your way and let you make your statement, which I thought was very eloquent and very well done. You look great on Fox News. It's mainstream. The message of disclosure, the petition, the public pressure, the public awareness, and really it's an intelligent awareness. It's not a paranoia about you're going to have to open all the warehouses and open all the files, and we want to see everything, including the dirty laundry and all the dead alien bones. Yeah. It's a very intelligent a thirst for knowledge that we have, that we are a self-aware race, and we're not alone in the universe, and we're ready to admit that. We're mature now. Let's admit it.
Right. And restructure our policies and our institutions to reflect this new reality. So what I'm going to be doing, Brooks, is the X conference is over, but it did lose a great deal of money, so I'm going to have to go find a serious funder. I'm still looking for that one major funder, $100,000 maybe, that would really be a game changer and allow PRG certainly to do so much more than it already is doing. I'll be going to Australia on the 22nd. I'll be down there for about 35 days, 12 cities. A lot of interest in the subject in Australia, of course, and Australia is a major intelligence ally of the United States. I think most people know that. And I think are very much involved in the ET issue in a significant way. I will then come back to the U.S. and then head to the U.K. on August the 6th. I'll be speaking at Leeds Exopolitics Conference. All this stuff's up on my website. You can find it all at paradigmresearchgroup.org. And possibly doing about a 2-3 week speaking tour of the U.K., Ireland, maybe over on the continent. Then I'll come back and continue to look for funding and work on the development of the next conference I would like to do, which is called Contact 2010, which would be devoted exclusively to the contact issue. In an effort to bring this particular matter, which is a pretty significant fact we haven't even discussed, into the forefront of the advocacy movement, the fact that unknown numbers, unknown thousands of human beings have been in direct contact with extraterrestrials, going back to their childhood, going back to their parents and their grandparents, and possibly going back hundreds of thousands of years. This has now been established, and it's no longer possible, I think, morally and strategically to step away from it. It's time to deal with it, and I expect to see more contactees coming out of the closet. I expect to see them becoming political. So, again, you know, the truth embargo days are numbered. I'm doing all I can. We've got, let's see, the Exopolitics World Network is still looking for new countries. And the Facts on Washington is still ongoing, and we invite people to go to factsonwashington.org, FFAX on Washington.org, and send letters off to the White House Press Corps demanding that they start asking the administration the obvious questions and not settle for anything but a serious answer. That's still happening and ongoing. I expect to be doing more speaking certainly, later in the year, and with any luck, we'll get a major funder and really take this into high gear.
Well, I think it's the hottest issue in the public domain right now, I think. I mean, we're not going to Mars. We're not going to the moon. The president's effectively ended manned space travel in our lifetimes, at least from the United States, unless we want to hitch a ride with another country. But we've lost our national
propaganda. I mean, nothing is what it seems. Everything they say about the space program is meaningless, in a sense. In other words, if they're cutting back on the space program, to me, that's a disclosure matter. In other words, if you know disclosure is close, then you do not want to have, you want to steal white elephant space programs that are completely anachronistic and totally bogus underway as possible. Because if you do, everybody's going to say, what in the hell are you doing spending money on that? Why did you do that? All that money could have been spent elsewhere. Oh, well, we had to maintain the truth embargo. So think of the best way to think about the actions regarding NASA and a lot of other stuff is that they know disclosure is coming. They need to batten down the hatches. They need to paint the poop deck. They need to get their story straight. They need to position themselves. Stephen Hawking is doing that. You probably noticed that. The Vatican Church is doing that. You can't stumble into a hotel without running into an exobiology or astrobiology conference. So, again, Brooks, we should be optimistic. that we're about to end this embargo, but we should never underestimate the need to continue to engage the government on this and not let the government dictate how this is all going to turn out. So I'm hoping that people will shake off the economic fears they have, and I know they're very worried, and try to find the funding to allow this advocacy to go forward and not leave it to the government to decide the post-disclosure world.
Yeah, exactly right. That's one of the pleas that we make on a regular basis here, that, you know, this isn't going to happen with a government grant. It's not going to happen with a new tax. This is only going to happen if you
They're not going to fund us to end their truth embargo, I can assure you.
That's right. It has to come from our pocketbook. Hey, we've got a caller on the line. Mark, welcome to the program.
Hi, Dr. Agnew. How are you tonight?
I'm doing wonderful. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good. I left a message for James. I think I'm going to try to make the conference.
Well, that'll be awesome. Have you been listening to the program tonight? We have Stephen Bassett on. We're talking about the disclosure of ET and UFO technology that our government's been holding on to probably for 60 years or more.
Yes, I certainly have, and I have a couple of questions and comments for Steve. First
sure.
of all, Steve, I am the webmaster for Exopolitics Ohio, and I think we chatted briefly a few times on some other radio shows.
Oh, what's your name?
Mark Snyder.
Oh, hi, Mark. Okay, well great. Yeah, one of my guys, Exopolitics Ohio. Thanks, Mark. I appreciate what you're doing, and we need to get about another 25 states going here. But we've got about 8 or 9 in play, and I really appreciate you're doing Ohio for us. Thank you.
Well, it's my pleasure. The approach that I'm taking with the website now is education. I have now 100 embedded videos on the website, and I cover contactees, researchers, history, and science as it relates to the UFO issue. Currently, I have hits from 15 different countries, so it's starting to come together pretty good. The one thing I'd like to bring up is a controversial case that I have a special interest in, and that's the Billy Meyer case. And I think that the evidence for that case is pretty overwhelming. There are 1,200 crystal clear daylight photos of the ships, 8mm films, sound recordings. We've got 100 eyewitnesses in Switzerland, and thousands of pages of contact notes written by Billy. But I wonder sometimes if the people that are in the UFO movement themselves are really ready to deal with some of the mind-bending realities associated with the phenomena. Can you comment on that?
The fact is, were we ready to deal with the mind-bending reality of relativistic physics? Were we ready to deal with the invention of the hydrogen and atomic bombs?
Or heavier than air flight.
With World War II, the banking collapse, the bust of 1929, the Iraq War, genetic experimentation. You know, the fact is that some of us are ready, some of us are not, but we're going in one direction here, right? It's not about what we're ready for. It's about what is. The human race has shown that it is incredibly adaptive, and I can assure you that 4 or 5 years after disclosure, for most people, will be a so what. And even if we have contact with ETs, within 3 or 4 years after that, hell, most kids will think nothing of it. Again, all of this business about what we can handle and not handle, I'm afraid, is far more about government propaganda and the effort to contain this issue until they're ready to deal with it or open up, and not really about what we're ready for or not ready for. Let me say this, that I'm not uncomfortable at all with disclosure and the post-disclosure world. And I've talked with a lot of people. So as far as I'm concerned, ready or not, here it comes.
Yeah, I don't think it's so much a treatment issue where people are socially or even emotionally or psychologically incapable of accepting that we're the only sentient beings in the neighborhood. I think it's more a question of how we're going to economically and socially adapt to that. Are we going to be sharing our planet? Are we going to be venturing to other planets? Are we going to be incorporating new equations of space folding star travel techniques into our schools? You know, this is the level of amazement and even curiosity that really makes the human race shine. We're at our best when we're like that, I think.
Yeah, but let's turn it around. I mean, I could ask another question. Are we ready for cheap energy? Are we ready for maybe being able to heat our houses for $4 or $5 a month? Are we ready to be able to run our cars on electricity that costs a couple of pennies a mile? Are we ready for unlimited fresh water from desalinization plants? Are we ready for the end of oil and its pollution and toxic waste? Are we ready for the end of the garbage patch in the middle of the Pacific? The space junk that's now a millionfold polluting our own atmosphere, polluting our own space around us. Are we ready for all of those things? Well, obviously we are. And so again, let's stick with it. It's basically going to keep it simple. Should a sentient species know the truth about the world that it lives in? I think absolutely. I believe that's natural law, fundamental law. That knowing the truth about the world you're in is a fundamental higher law that no country can legislate away. No,
I couldn't agree more.
And any attempt to do that is fundamentally illegal and cannot be justified. And so we need to enter a period where never again, ever again, will any nation, any state, any government ever attempt to misrepresent fundamental reality to people. The governments are made up of other people. They are not supreme beings. They are not geniuses. They are not superior to us. And in many cases, they are profoundly inferior. They in no way have the basis, the justification, the credibility, or the imprimatur to define reality other than what it is. And to do so violates fundamental law. Now, I understand national security, and we went through World War II and the nuclear threat of the Soviet Union. I understand all that. We have to get beyond those things as well. But in a simpler, broader sense, we need to commit ourselves to the fact that never again will we allow reality to be misrepresented to us by any institution. We can lie to ourselves and each other about the way things are all we want. But institutional lying about the nature of reality by the church, by the state, by the PTA, by anybody in government, must never be allowed to happen again. And I don't think it will. I think that we will have learned that lesson profoundly the day after disclosure.
Very good. We the people fill in the blank. Mark, any other thoughts for this hour?
Yeah, I'll go ahead and I'd like to bring up one other issue, and then I'll hang up and let you guys discuss this. I'd like to hear you both discuss ancient artificial structures that may be on the moon, Mars, and our own solar system, and the fact that human history may go back millions of years, and some of the evidence for that is the monolithic structures that are on the Earth still, like at Pumapunku and even the Great Pyramid. And I think that learning the truth of our own history will come out with the disclosure of the UFO phenomena. And I'll be listening
very
offline.
Well,
good evening. Thank you very much.
To that.
That's a nice question to end with. It has about a 45-hour answer. Keep it simple.
Hey, can we take a four-minute break? Hey, Steve, let's go ahead and take a quick four-minute break so I can make sure people can get this on their iPod, and we'll be back right after this, all right? Hold on. We'll be back in about 4 minutes. Don't go away, people. More Stephen Bassett and Disclosure. We'll be back right after this with more X Squared Radio. right, welcome back to X Squared Radio. Had to take a short break, let our affiliates do their thing. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. Our guest tonight is Stephen Bassett, and he is out there selflessly leading the exopolitical movement for disclosure. His website is paradigmresearch.org. I encourage you to go there. There's lots of information on there, lots of ways you can participate. Newsletter, ways you can donate, help out financially. As I have always said in this program, disclosure and the great ideas, including renewable energy, are not going to come from government programs. They're not going to come from universities. They're going to be driven by you, the consumer, which means the reason you can't go down to the store right now and buy this stuff is because the money to get it off the drawing board and into the manufacturing plants has not been raised yet. You have to do that. You have to find companies and find organizations like Paradigm Research, and you've got to start sending them money. $5, $10, $15 a month, if a couple hundred thousand people did that, our worries would be over. We would have electric cars, we'd have renewable energy, we'd have reduced oil spills, we would have cheap, available energy, clean water around the world, and we'd have a handle on most of these problems that are plaguing us. But you, the listener, have to take the reins in your hands, and you have to contribute. That means you're going to have to voluntarily tax yourself $10 or $12 a month, find 10 or 12 of these organizations that you can find, that you feel good about, that you resonate with, and write them a check. Send them a PayPal payment once a month for $5. I promise you, 10,000 people doing that would solve the problem forever. Organizations like Stephen Bassett's would be off the ground and be able to open these warehouses of knowledge and spread them around the world and change the course of history. We do not have to march down the eschatological path toward Armageddon as the prophets laid out for us. All of those predictions and prophecies are conditional. If we continue with our head up our own rears, that's what's going to happen. But if we take control, because we are now aware, we are now empowered with a new vision of a new future, then we can change course. And that's exactly what we're talking about tonight. Now, we're going to continue with Mark's question that he left with us in the last hour. He wants Stephen and I to consider the ancient structures that have been left on the earth, the Great Pyramid at Giza, the mysterious precision rock work that's been done at Punga Punga around the world, Machu Picchu and places like this. What were these advanced civilizations doing? How long have they been here? What kind of technology did it take to make that happen? Welcome my guest back now. Stephen, welcome back to the program.
Hi, Brooks. Quick clarification, that's paradigmresearchgroup.org.
Yeah, I know he's there. He might be muted at the moment. Maybe his signal's a little bit weak, but he'll come back on in a moment.
Am I not there? I should be here. Can you hear me?
There we go. Now we can hear you.
Yeah, I think you didn't have me switched over yet. Yeah, I just want to clarify, that's paradigmresearchgroup.org. Don't forget the group.
Sorry. Left a word out. ParadigmResearchGroup.org.
I certainly commend to your listeners a wonderful series that was just run on history called Ancient Aliens. It's by Prometheus Films. They had some good money behind them and did a rather amazing 10 hours, plus the initial one, which was done about a year ago. So it's 12 hours of material. Definitely will raise the issues for people, and it was well received. It's not my area of specialty. But I will say this, I have a strong confidence that the ETs have been interacting with humans, Homo sapiens sapiens, for a very, very long time. I do not know, I have no sense of what human civilization was like pre-cataclysm, whether there was much. We know a lot about what happened after the cataclysm. And furthermore, I know that a great deal of human history since then, which is approximately 12,000 years, is going to be rewritten, and it's going to be fun. It's kind of a much less threatening and more benign and amazing process that we'll see underway, where we will reexamine all of human history with the extraterrestrial reality in tow. And I'm sure that we're going to come to some very startling new conclusions about our history, which will be great. And I don't think it's that threatening. and I think it'll be extraordinary. I think it'll excite the kids at school and launch 1,000 courses. And I look forward to seeing it happen. And for those who have tried to figure it out ahead of time, without disclosure yet under the bridge, my hat's off to them, because let me tell you, that is very difficult work. And they had a tough task, but they've made good efforts, and they have certainly brought us some amazing information.
I couldn't agree more. If you want to be part of our program, we have about 45 minutes left. The number is 415-762-1161. Anywhere on planet or off planet, if you can get to a cell phone tower, you can reach us, 415-762-1161. We're talking about disclosure. What does that mean? It means opening up the vaults, the files, the warehouses, the crates, and sharing with the world, at least the American people, what has been discovered. Now, not necessarily everything that's been reverse engineered. I don't really want weaponry that's been developed with this, by reverse engineering ET technology, released to the world. But I do think that there are sources of energy, or at least energy treatment systems, that could make a big difference on the shortage and even the nature, the polluting nature of the energy that we do use on our planet. Now, we've had the benefit for about 100 years of petroleum. We've used diesel fuel. We've used gasoline. We've used kerosene, jet fuel. But I have to tell you, the burning of fossil fuels is caveman stuff compared to the energy sources that lie in the vaults of disclosure. What have you learned about what might be available in the secret government vaults that are out there, Stephen?
Wait, did you say what have my researcher colleagues learned? I'm not a researcher per se. Well, first of all, let me mention that I just sent out an international press release, about 3,000, and I had fun doing it, got a lot of positive response, and essentially what it was it said that PRG releases today some timely questions for the consideration of American citizens, members of Congress, and the political media. And the questions were, are you offended by this? And there's a photo of the Gulf oil spill. And if the answer is yes, then the second question was, do you think these? And then there's a photo in the press release of a damn good-looking saucer, let me tell you, high quality, top-of-the-line Mercedes 25,000. And do you think these run on this? And then there's a picture of 3 or 4 barrels of oil. If the answer to that question is yes, then these questions need to be posed to the Department of Defense, the National Security Agency, and the Central Intelligence Agency. And the three questions are, by our Congress, by our citizens, and, of course, by our political media, does the United States have in its possession technology of an extraterrestrial origin? Two, has the United States been for the last 60 years studying the physics and propulsion, energy and propulsion physics of these craft? And finally, when will this technology be available to address the challenges that are currently facing the human race?
Yeah, well, it ain't coming through General Motors. Let's see what Crystal has to say from BC. Welcome to the program, Crystal.
Well, hello. Yes, really good show. And I must say, Stephen, I admire your passion and what you're doing. I'm one of those contactees that is gradually coming out of the closet. So I do kind of have a point of view here. I'm wondering if, you know, I kind of, listening to James Gilliland, who's been on a few times, Brooks, he's sort of stated that disclosure has already begun. You know, for a lot of people, it seems to me that there's very heavy contact for people that are just, you know, normal people. They're not leaders.
Well,
not to say
the
leaders aren't normal. But I mean, you know, just the average Joe. That seems to be where, now I don't know anything about abduction. I haven't had that sort of experience. mine has been very positive. But, you know, the positive ETs seem to be leaning toward the idea that we shouldn't be looking for leadership, but we should be learning sovereignty and raising our consciousness in that way. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's like the ranch, all these people, you know, the ET presence is being disclosed to them. You know, that I don't think any of them are looking toward the government. And
I agree with you that the ET presence is very widely known and even maybe more widely accepted than even the three of us could imagine. But what we're really talking about here is a crack in the dam, just a little trickle. A few fingers could keep it stemmed. But very soon the dam is going to burst, and the flood of knowledge is going to pour out upon the human race. And I think
excuse me for interrupting, but I think the ones that the ETs are very aware of that, and that's why they are doing individual contact. Because, you know, like, you know, the point that someone did bring up that called in earlier, you know, can the public handle that kind of reality? Well, I know for myself, it's taken me 10 years to transform my old beliefs. You know, I used to be a Christian. It was very difficult for me. You know, and I wasn't like I was kind of a quasi-Christian. I wasn't like brought up in a family that was, you know, really strict that way. So, I mean, for me, it was very, very difficult. And it's been 10 years that I've been able to wrap my head around some of these new concepts and raising my consciousness. You know, and I think, you know, I would like to go out, like I almost finished my book, but not in the point of leadership. Just, I think the more people of us that do this, like what James Gilliland is doing, what you are doing, Brooks, what I'm going to do, opens up a gradual acceptance. And I think you have to have a certain
number. I understand the gradual acceptance, but do you think that dumping all of this knowledge, just basically running out on Main Street and dumping all the filing cabinets out of the 10-story windows to the public is the way to go? Or do you think going through organizations like Stevens that's got, you know, rank and file scientists and experts who are able to go through this information, and you know, exopolitics is not just an activist group, it's also an awareness group that teaches us, or at least could disclose to us in an organized way, what could be safe to play with and what could not be safe to play with? What is an energy source and what is
I think that, yeah, I agree. They do have an important role, but I think from what I've learned, it's really important not to, I mean, that's why the ETs haven't gone to the government. You know, we don't need more leaders. We need a coming together of understanding, you know, at a very deep level. Because Stephen Hawking, I think, was right. You have to be careful. If we look, so many people believe in the Bible. Well, you look at the Sumerian texts. I think we've been in control by negative ETs. And we have to come out of that very deep-rooted, intrinsic belief system, you know, that is so prevalent in people today. And that's, like I said, I know myself how difficult that can be. So I think we all have a role. But, you know, when I was first contacted, I just wanted to get out there and tell everybody, you know, and I was almost like a zealous religious fanatic until I just got squashed, you know, and I thought, okay, I got to back off here and look at this differently. And like I said, it's taken 10 years to really wake up. But, so that's, I'm not saying that it's a bad thing, exopolitics or anything, and I think it's a good thing, you know, but I think we sort of have to be careful, too, how we go about this, because you're looking at a whole world of people that have been, like I said, I was told by the ETs, intrinsically ingrained in them that, you know, things are a certain way. And we have to, you know, get rid of all that, transform it, and it's going to take time.
Well, what do you think, Stephen? Are we is it just as bad a neighborhood out there as it is down here?
I got it. But let me clarify here. First of all, Crystal's right. Disclosure with a small D has been going on for quite some time. General, a substantial amount of acclimatization has been going on for decades. And will continue to go on. The disclosure that we have been talking about on this show tonight, though, is in fact with a capital D. I have to make that distinction all the time, and I'm happy to do it, because eventually people will understand. Capital D disclosure is an event. It is a political act. It is the formal acknowledgement of the extraterrestrial presence of the governments of the world. It's not, you know, somebody in Congress telling you to come to a party, oh, yeah, no, it's true. No, it's the President of the United States, it's Vladimir Putin, Medvedev, Sarkozy, Clegg, Cameron. It is the leaders of nations going before the people and acknowledging the ET presence of Israel. That's disclosure. Could take 5 minutes. That's it. It's done. Now, disclosure with a small d, of course, will continue on. With respect to that, believe me, I never expected, and will not, and I'm sure will not see, the dumping of information out on the cycle. That ain't going to happen. And the information that we need is not from Paradigm Research Group. It's from the government. We need to know as much as possible about what the government knows, what the government has, and we need access to that technology. That will happen in the post-disclosure world. It will start the day after disclosure. And it will be...
Well, the only question I have about that, okay, is the disclosure that was given to us, let's say, eons ago, when ETs first came on this planet, it was all about control, you know, and I think a lot of people see that with governments today. It's all about control. And, you know, so I, for one, if there is anything a government is going to disclose, I wouldn't trust it, number one. The ETs I've been contacted by have left. You know, they helped me to wake up, and they've taught me sovereignty, to think for myself, and to be a higher conscious being. You know, and that it doesn't depend on a government disclosing anything to me, quite frankly. You know, so I mean,
this distinction is very important.
I know what you're saying, but I think... But anyway, I really did want to bring that into... that's what my book is about.
I think that the individual really, communication, like Crystal's talking about, has been going on for maybe millions of years. Also, the social control that Crystal's been talking about, I think there's evidence of that in the Sumerian texts and even in other civilizations, the Shining Ones and others that came here. They were treated as gods. They were worshipped, and they took advantage of that, it appears, at least in the records that we have. I don't think we're looking at that same kind of scenario here. I think we're going to look at them more like neighbors then we're going to look at them like angels. And I think...
I'm saying that I think they are still in control. You know, I think a lot of the... our whole system was built on that. You know, it's a mindset. It's a consciousness. It's a system that is built on that original system. You know, it's our whole political everything. You know, it's built on controls, and that is the whole thing that I think has to fall apart before we can know. And you have to have a different mindset before you can know how to pick up the pieces and build something new, because you don't want to build the same old thing again. No, I believe that that we are definitely, if not directly controlled by ETs, just indirectly through the way man has been taught, you know. I mean, it's amazing what Sitchin wrote and found in those texts about gold. You know, you can kind of question, well, why do we have this thing about money and gold? you know, it's carried on right through. And I think that's the big thing that has to be broken open. Maybe we have to know our history first before we...
Certainly, we've taken that alchemical principle to the next level. And we haven't made lead into gold. We've made paper into gold, which is even more remarkable feat. What about it, Stephen? Are we looking at post-disclosure world as only functioning properly if we go through anarchy first?
No, I don't see that. I think there are multiple processes underway. I've talked to hundreds of contactees. I'm working right now with a contactee named Kim Carlsberg to help her get her third book out, which is going to be an extremely cool book called Art of Close Encounters, which is going to help introduce a lot of people to the subject. Part of the disclosure with a small d that's been going on has been direct contact with an ET human being. How many? How long? Well, one day we'll know, perhaps. But
Stephen Hawking has the right idea there.
Let me make this quick. This process is resulting in individuals coming to personal understanding and personal involvement. That's all going on. Transitions in history and transitions in politics is also made up of individual personal transitions. It's just like the Civil Rights Movement. It wasn't just the passage of the Civil Rights Act. It wasn't just the passage of certain laws and the end of Jim Crow law. You know, millions of people that lived in the South under segregation evolved and changed their views about it and looked at people and themselves in different ways. So that's also going on. But I also want to make quite clear that what governments do is very important. In other words, I'll give you a simple example. There are many, many people in our country right now that are committed to peace. They do not want more war. They certainly do not want unnecessary wars. And they are evolving, and they are trying to be peaceful in nature. But yet the government, as we know, can launch a war anytime it wants. And when it does, it can take your son and daughter and send them to that war. And so the idea that we'll just evolve and not worry about what the government does, I'm afraid that's not a luxury that we can afford. My activism...
Yeah, and I think the way to stop the wars, I think when we, like with the, if, let's say a soldier had an ET experience as positive as mine, he will just lay down his guns. He won't need the government to tell him that he has to, that he can lay them down now or that he could pick it up. That's what my point is. You know, it's really important that people see, I mean, these ETs that are of a positive nature are very high consciousness, not better than us, but just a higher consciousness. And so we have to be able to, you know, work on that level too. And like you said, it is happening. There's, you know, peace movements and it will get to the point where we don't need the government to tell us that we don't have to fight anymore. We just won't. That's where I'm at. You know, I'm not a person of any great education or anything, but I do. My consciousness has risen, and you know, there's more love in my heart now than was 10 years ago. And you know, reaching out to people in a loving way is I think. And like I said, when that soldier lays down his gun, then I think we're ready. You know. But, okay, I shall get off the phone and let you guys carry on. And thank you so much for giving me the opportunity.
Thank you very much, Crystal, for the call. You can call back anytime.
Thank you. Bye.
All right, good night. I don't think that's all that rare, Stephen. That I do hear people out there who are saying, the whole thing's got to fall apart and then we got to rebuild it. But I think... in this day and age, that is an incredibly, in fact, maybe even impossible task. I don't think we're ready to cast aside.
You don't want everything to fall apart. In a modern state like ours, if that would happen, it would be unbearable.
Sure, it would be.
It would be extremely dangerous and incredibly costly. This is not a luxury that we can afford. But again, she's speaking metaphorically in some ways. Look. I can only handle so much. My job is to engage the United States government, and to some degree engage other governments around the world through the international movement, which is growing, to change policy.
Well, I guess so the question that comes to mind, you know, when you talk about engage the government, you mentioned earlier we have an elected government, a bureaucratic government, and then the secret government. Which one are you engaging?
All of them. And the way you right. do that is through the media. Remember what I said? Whether you're working at Area 51 or Tulsi, whether you're a GS-19 working at the Navy labs, whether you're a member of Congress, you go home, you watch television, you watch the news, you read the newspapers, you go online, you go to church, whatever. And so we have the power now, particularly if we get the funding, to use the media, the internet, to get the message out. And if you get it out there into the flow, it gets heard and listened to by everybody. And all three levels of the government I'm talking about. And they listen. And so you speak to them that way. No, you're not going to get invited to a behind-the-scenes meeting at Area 51. I'm not going to get invited to the White House. But when we held the press conference at the National Press Club after X-Conference 2009, where Edgar Mitchell, astronaut, of course, Apollo astronaut, Apollo 14, called on the Obama administration to end the truth embargo, CNN cameras were there, and they broadcast it worldwide to the Internet, live stream. And you can bet your bottom dollar that members of the White House heard that. He was interviewed by a number of media afterwards. He would have had more, but he had a very ill member of family. He had to go right back to Florida. But over 50 or 60, and I've logged them all. You can go to my website, read them all. Articles were done about that. I can assure you that members of all three levels of government we talk about are aware of Edgar Mitchell and what he said. We speak to them through
right.
the media, by our accents.
Yeah,
and by our programs.
You know, every year they parade Neil Armstrong out to make his public statements, but this year he came out and he spoke about how terrible it was that we have ended manned spaceflight in this country. That was a real change of stripes for Neil Armstrong, who's sort of been the, pull the string in the back of the neck patriot that backed the White House on pretty much anything it wanted to do. But this time he came out and said, no, Mr. President, we cannot stop exploring space. This doesn't work for us.
So, of course, the question for Neil right away is, you know, Dr. Armstrong, are you aware that we are exploring space? What do you know about our secret space fleet? What do you know about our anti-gravitic craft? So is Neil completely ignorant of that and actually befuddled that we're suddenly not going to back off all these programs? Or is Neil well aware of the fact that we have the black programs? And by coming forward and raising a ruckus, he's drawing attention to this, odd thing. He's at least drawing attention to this discrepancy, what's the word I'm looking for? It's a bit of a paradox. I don't know. It's the same thing about Hawking. When Hawking comes out and makes such a simple-minded statement, which he really is, that, well, you know, these extraterrestrials could be dangerous. We ought to be careful. I mean, my Lord, you'd think he was talking to a couple of second-grade kids in an elementary school. Now, Hawking is a lot smarter than that. He knows it's far more sophisticated than that. So why did he do that? Was that Stephen Hawking's way of bringing the ET issue up? Basically what he said is, oh, yeah, there's ETs out there, but be careful about them. Well, I'm more interested in the statement there's ETs out there than to be careful. Hawking knows more knows a lot more, I think, than he's saying. And so, again, you have to look at all this through the prism of the truth embargo and the constraints we're under. Everything is not what it seems. What people say is not what they really mean. The program announcements are not where we're really going. The real program is not what you see above ground. This kind of charade, this kabuki theater, while it might be amusing to go and watch occasionally on a weekend for a bit of entertainment, is a hell of a way to run a nation. I can assure you, kabuki theater is not the way to govern the United States. And if we continue to do that, we're going to have a second world country on our hands pretty soon. And we're all going to be living in tents in the national forest. So my point is not about the specifics of any one thing, but looking at the collective, larger picture and trying to see the bigger patterns. And the bigger patterns are other nations are losing patience with the truth embargo. Witnesses are coming forward. High-level people that don't dare actually, crossed the line, are making rather interesting statements that are drawing attention to the issue, not the least of which is the Catholic Church and Jose Gabriel Funes, that astronomer, and on and on and on. When you look at the big picture, you see us moving towards some major breaking point here, which is the disclosure event with a capital D. Now, Crystal's thoughts were important to me because I am assuming I can get some funding because I owe it $40,000 after the X conference. But the point is, assuming I get more funding, I'm going to move to get this Contact 2010 conference underway, which will be the first major conference dealing exclusively with contact since the 1992 Alien Abduction Study Conference held by John Mack and David Pritchard at MIT. That's 18 years ago. And the reason I want to do that is because it's time to bring the contact issue into the forefront of the advocacy movement. But believe me, I understand that the complexity of the totality of these experiences is huge. And I'm not trying to create some sort of lockstep movement here. I know that every contactee has their own personal sense of what is happening, and they have their own information that they've been given or have asked about. They have their own very powerful and deep emotional personal views about it, and they are very different from person to person. There's a very broad spectrum. And so it is not an easy thing to bring this into play. But understand, my point is not to impose some sort of contactee ideology here, but rather to simply say, I don't care what's going on between the ET and that human. I don't really care what the ET is telling them overall. There is contact going on, and that is enough right there to have thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, if not millions of Americans in direct contact with extraterrestrials and have their own government deny that it is even happening or exists, to be unable to talk to even your family in many cases. And when you do, to lose your job. I think we have seen that before. This is not acceptable, and the time has come to make that clear. Whatever the totality of the contact experience is, it is no longer tolerable, right, as part of our society to force these people to live in the closet because the government refuses to deny the very reality around them. And so I'm going to try to do that, while I know it is fraught with some complexities.
That's true. That's true. I see that there is a pathology that's driven into our sociology of our country because, as you say, millions of Americans have had contact in their own way. Some of it's been face-to-face. They've gone onto ships. They've had telepathic messages. They are convinced, as convinced as they are that Jesus is the Christ or Hare Krishna or Muhammad or whatever, they're as convinced of that as they are of anything, of their own reality. And yet they have a government saying that it doesn't exist, it has never existed, and if you believe in it, you're not acceptable as a stable human being in our government. That pathology is probably what's fundamentally wrong with the relationship between our individuals of our society and our government.
The ET contactees will be the last group in the last closet, I suspect. Gay Americans are coming out in greater and greater numbers. I think it won't be that long before closeted gays will be quite rare. They're also exerting enormous political influence. Contactees will be coming out soon in great numbers, and they, I think, will be the last. After disclosure, they will be able to come forward at will. And after that, I don't know if there's any closeted people. I know this. We as a people, as a nation, need to set our sights on a country that is closet-free. In other words, you do not want a nation where people are forced to live in a closet because they're unable to even talk about the fundamental reality of their life. That is not acceptable. They have a right to do it. They have a right to be as private as they want to be, but to be forced to do it because of the condemnation and peer pressure, the loss of job or anything else, is absolutely unacceptable. We need to be a closet-free nation in that regard. That will be one of the great reforms that will be post-disclosure, I think, thread. I will certainly support it. And with any luck, the ET contactees will be the last people in any closet in our culture. And once they're out, that won't be an issue anymore. So that just gives you a taste of the breadth of this, the scope of it, how many ways and how many aspects of our culture it gets into. This is massive. It's beyond anything we've ever seen as a civilization. I believe it's certainly beyond anything any activist movement has ever seen. It's off the charts. It is, and at times it's overwhelming, and yet it will be resolved. More funding will come forward. More people will step up. More press will come over our side. More countries will release more documents. This is going to be resolved, and pretty soon. And I encourage people to get ready and think as much as they can about how they are going to, what they plan to do in the post-disclosure world. What, you know, I hope to write a book one day called The Day After Disclosure. What are they going to do the day after disclosure?
That's a powerful question.
The disclosure is just the beginning.
What is the beginning of a massive
geopolitical social transition that will offer great opportunities for systemic change that could dramatically improve the life of billions of people. That's a big deal.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the change in our remaining 10 minutes here. You know, that change could be that now what was once cloaked UFOs flying in broad daylight, most people can't see them, uncloak themselves, and now we see fleets of UFOs of various types and shapes and colors going through our skies. Are we going to be fighting over the technology? And even a greater question, are the ETs going to be fighting over us and our planet?
I don't know. Again, I don't know what the ETs do. They don't talk to me. But, you know, humans are capable of fighting over anything, including which end of an egg is the one to open first. But the point is that it'll be such an eye-opening change come disclosure that I anticipate a much more expansive and mature assessment of things in the post-disclosure world. Don't expect to see fleets of saucers. No, no, no. But I will not be surprised at all if open contact doesn't take place within a couple of years after disclosure. It's not going to surprise me one bit. I can't.
Yeah, I feel that way too.
And I can't predict it, but everything in my body, every fiber within me says, you get disclosure, you get contact, and pretty quickly. How long, you know, I don't know. You know, it's like courtship. You meet somebody, and not surprisingly, it takes a couple of years or so, perhaps to really get to know them well enough to commit your whole life to them. So, you know, you get engaged, a couple of years later, you get married. Everybody understands that. Disclosure means that, okay, they are real. They're here. Now, that's going to take a little getting used to. And how long will it take? 6 months? 6 weeks? A year? 2 years? I have decided it's about 2 years. You know? Given the American's attention span, it might be 2 days. I don't know. But let's think about 2 years.
Just to go on with your analogy, sometimes we learn enough about another person and we don't want to have anything to do with them anymore. Are we going to find ourselves post-disclosure? I want to go back to when it was a rumor.
It's like somebody back in the 1500s says, what do you mean? What, the Earth goes around the sun? I didn't order that. I want nothing
exactly
to do with that. I mean, okay, fine. The Earth is still going around the sun, you understand. So you may not want anything to do with them, but they're here regardless. So let's just, you know, and at some point you have to hope for the best, you know, Brooks. Let's face it. Life is one damn thing after another. You get up in the morning, you're not even sure you're going to be alive by dusk. I mean, so
well,
ETs
that's
are here.
True. Who wants to go on as a society?
ETs are here to deal with it. I mean, that could be that'll end up being the motto on some T-shirts. You can count on that.
Yeah, and who wants to go on as a society with a pathology based on a rumor? Wouldn't you rather know the truth? Isn't the truth easier to handle? Easier to base the future of a world upon?
Look, you know, here's another nice analogy I like to throw out there. I'm a baby boomer. You're close, I think. You and I have pretty much lived most of the first, you know, the first half of our entire life was lived under the threat of total and nuclear annihilation. End of the country, end of possibly most of civilization to nuclear winter, a complete breakdown of society, hell on earth, where the living, you know, are envied by the dead. We lived under that for 30 years, and we're still here. Sure, Americans consume mass amounts of antacids and take mood-altering drugs by the ton, and maybe I think the Cold War had a lot to do with that. But we survived. Frankly, living under the reality that ETs are here and there's other civilizations is, to me, a hell of a lot stressful than living under the nuclear Damocles sword for 35 years. When I was 22 years old, Brooks, I assumed I would never see 35. I was absolutely certain we'd have a nuclear war. The entire history of the human race indicated you build weapons and use them. The idea that we would build all these weapons and never use them, to me, was absurd. I assumed I would die in a nuclear war. Yeah, that's not particularly conducive to, how would you say, psychological contentment. But that's what we had, and we lived with it.
We did. We did. I lived under the same cloak. I hid under the same school desks that you did.
Absolutely. And they would have saved us.
Or so they said.
We'd have walked out of that school, hugging those desks, going, oh, thank God I had my desk.
That's right. I'm glad. Oh, my goodness. My elementary school walls are going to save me.
Yeah. I mean, you have to look. Look, here's the deal. We're humans, right? Humans are capable of making jokes as they walk onto the gallows. We've done it. It's happened. We can laugh at anything. We can laugh at the universe, the cosmos, death. We'll laugh at this. And we do. Stand-up comedians will make good livings making jokes about extraterrestrials very soon.
Yep.
I've been told
two
to do
aliens
that myself,
walked into
but
a bar.
I wouldn't know what to do if I made a good living, Brooks, so I'll avoid that. But the point is that we are very adaptive.
I know what
we'll
you
handle
mean.
This. We'll move on. We'll be fine.
Yeah. Wow. Absolutely amazing. Steven, you do great work, and we believe in you. I said, Steven, you do great work, and we believe in you, and I know it's tough out there. Gosh, I've spoken on the same venue with you before, and I know we're both out there picking crumbs with the sparrows trying to put this message together and tell a story and wake people up, but it feels good to do it, so we're out there doing it.
Yeah, we got the greatest of I shouldn't complain. I should never complain. The reason I want the funding is not to live well. I want the funding to be able to do the job right, be effective. The last serious funder was Rockefeller, and he died a couple years ago, and since then no one stepped forward. But I know that there's a second baseman playing for the Dodgers or a Hollywood starlet making $10 million a picture or a high-tech internet guy that's worth $300 million any day. One of them is going to come forward and say, you know, this is the greatest issue of all time, and I could be a significant factor in it. I think I'll support this. I don't care what the government says about the issue, and I'm not afraid of it. I'm hoping that's going to happen soon, because we need to be players here. I do not want the government dictating the post-disclosure world to us like it has dictated everything else. Yeah. I don't want them shaping that world. We need to be part of that, and if we don't build structures and we don't support the citizen entities, then the government will carry the day, and we'll live in their world once more.
Well, somewhere out there is a new musician who's going to make a gazillion dollars and feels that this is more worthwhile than having a Cadillac Escalade for each day of the week.
And it's a different color, too.
That's right. That's right.
Tuesday, it's pink. Yeah. Well, there's a lot of thinking that way. Look, I know some, and they do want to make a difference, but there is a truth embargo, and they're a little afraid to go there. But I'm telling you, they shouldn't be afraid. You see the witnesses coming forward. You see Edgar Mitchell. No one's bothering me. Really, it's there. It's the great event of all time. The great issue of all time is there for the taking. They can engage it. They can mold it. They can be involved. They're not going to get killed. They're not going to probably even get threatened. But they just have to shake off that truth embargo. They got to pop themselves aside the head a little bit and just, you know, make it go away. It's in the mind. It's not a real wall. It's a wall in the mind. It's a ghetto in the mind the government created to withhold the issue. That's all falling apart now. And so it's okay. Come forward. Engage this issue. It's numero uno. No other issue comes close. If somebody wants to make a case to me that the Japanese whaling in the Antarctic is a bigger issue than the presence of extraterrestrials, I'll listen, right? If they want to make an argument to me that Al-Qaeda and its existence is bigger than the extraterrestrial presence, I'm willing to listen. But nobody's going to attempt it because it would be absurd.
Yep,
there's
it would be.
It's close to this issue. This is it. This is the big one. This changes everything. Are we going to engage it? Or are we going to be passive?
Well, hopefully we've engaged it. We've talked about it thoroughly over the last 2 hours. And I will tell you one thing. It has been an absolute pleasure having you on the program. I love meeting you out there on the lecture circuit. I love having you on the program. You're a great energy, Stephen.
All right. Well, Brooke, save me a small cabin booth, a berth, rather, when you sail off to the Arctic, because I need a vacation.
I will. That's the adventure of my lifetime. It's all I can handle.
Fair enough.
All right, my friend. I'll let you back to it. Be safe in Australia, and please stay in touch. We'll keep monitoring you every day.
You're welcome, Brooks. Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
All right. Thank you very much. Again, Stephen Bassett's website is ParadigmResearchGroup.org. ParadigmResearchGroup.org. He has a Facebook out there. Keep up with it. Keep up with his Twitter. Find out what's going on. This is an instantaneous world of activism, which he is the tip of the spear. And let me tell you, it's lonely at the top. There's a lot of stress. There's a lot of challenge out there. It's not that anybody's challenging him or threatening him or following him around in black sedans. That's not happening. It just takes money to make people aware. Come on, look at the money that General Motors spends trying to tell you that they're in the electric car business. And you still don't believe it, and neither do I. But that's okay. We're talking about the major issues right here on X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew, and we will be back with you next week. Thank you so much for being part of our program. It has been a great pleasure to have you here with us this evening. Tell a friend about us, because every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we bring you the best 3 hours of exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours, send us the call letters of your local station, and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth Explorers, that you are Source. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. This is X Squared Radio, saying, Peace, Earth Explorers.